these on?
Oh, yeah, they are.
There we go.
Check, check.
Okay, I would like to call to order the afternoon session of the Goleta City Council. Will you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, would you call us to order there, Mr. Kataya?
Councilmember Aceves.
Here.
Councilmember Bennett.
Here.
Councilmember Perotti.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
Here.
Mayor Farr.
Here. Okay, we had a closed session meeting. Was there a report out of that?
The City Council did meet in a closed session on a special meeting this morning, and that was on performance evaluation pursuant to Section 54957B with regard to the City Attorney's annual performance evaluation. No reportable action was taken.
All right, thank you. And now is the time for public forum for people to speak about things that are not going to be discussed otherwise as part of our agenda. I have one speaker, Scott Burns.
Thank you, Mayor and City Council members. My name is Scott Burns. I'm representing Donate Life. Donate Life is an organization that helps with organ donations throughout the United States. As you guys probably know, you have been supporting Donate Life for the last 10 or 12 years. Generally, Joe Darga is the gentleman who is here. I think most of you know he unfortunately passed away a few months ago. With that being said, I'm going to read a short paragraph. This holiday season, Donate Life would like to thank each of you by helping us inspire the community to save lives and heal lives through organ, eye, and tissue donations. In recognition of the support of the City of Goleta, Donate Life is dedicating a rose on your behalf on the Donate Life parade float in the Rose Bowl Parade. So if any of you guys are able or willing to personally be there as the rose is dedicated, you are welcome. And going a little off script, if you're actually no longer in office by then, you're still welcome. And if a couple of you guys want to come separately with family, you're still welcome. My name is Scott Burns. I'm going to hand this paperwork to David, and it's got my phone number. And if anybody's interested, get a hold of me, and I'll make the arrangements. I will be down at the Rose Bowl to help you, show you around. The other thing, this year, the Rose Bowl Parade and Parade will be on Monday, January 2nd, because it's traditional not to have it on Sunday, supposedly because back many years ago, the horses would be scared by the church bells. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And I feel that I have to say, and that I said it a couple of times before, but you will not hear from me again, that I had a kidney transplant 30 years ago from my sister, and in effect, it was a new life. So, I mean, you truly are, if the opportunity presents itself and you're comfortable with it, you can change a life for sure. So,
thank you, Scott.
All right, are there any adjustments or amendments to the agenda?
There are no adjustments or amendments.
All right. You could put that on tape, you know, and just... Okay, now, Mr. Clerk, if you would.
Item A1, Beacon Spotlight Award.
All right, here's Cindy Moore. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Cindy Moore, Sustainability Coordinator, and I am very happy to be here today because I get to update you with some good news on the city's participation in the Institute for Local Government's Beacon Program. And you might recall the Beacon Program provides a framework for local governments to share best practices on saving energy and adopting policies to help make our communities more sustainable. And the Beacon Award is a way that the ILG actually recognizes and honors this voluntary effort by local governments in five areas of accomplishment. So there's energy and natural gas savings by agencies, there's greenhouse gas reductions by agencies and the community, and then there are sustainability best practice in 10 different activity areas. So at the recent League of Cities conference in Long Beach in October, the city was recognized with two of five of these awards, known as Spotlight Awards, and we received a Platinum Award for energy savings of 25% for energy efficiency activities between 2010 and 2015, and most of these projects related to lighting upgrades within city facilities, so here at City Hall, at the Goleta Valley Community Center, and then at our intersections, the highway safety lighting was upgraded. And then we received a second award for best practices in sustainability, and this involves a number of different projects throughout all departments at the city. So it's just, I think, important to recognize that there are a lot of staff members that are involved in those projects, not just myself here. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to express my appreciation to you for supporting the city's participation in this program, and then also present these awards to the mayor, if I could come forward.
Now, am I allowed to pawn these?
I think they're trying to get your picture over there.
All right. I could stand up here.
I feel
here,
like I'm photobombing.
And then people would be betting on the odds. Photoshop me to look like George Clooney. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Cindy.
May I say
A word from Councilmember Perotti.
Ms. Moore, Cindy Moore, I just want to thank you so much for all your hard work on being our sustainability coordinator. And I know that the mayor and I have the advantage of sitting with you on that committee, the Green and Energy Issues Committee, and I know how hard you work on all of. And so years ago when I went to one of my first conferences at League of Cities, they talked about this Beacon Award, and here we are. We are receiving recognition for the things that we're doing here in the city, so I think it has a lot to do with you and your work, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and sometimes, I don't know, we should get a general harangue on you looking down the future here 20 years to see where the society's going and where as a city we should be moving. I mean, I know there are a number of initiatives that we are undertaking, so.
There are, and we're going to be launching our sustainability plan development process this year, so that's good. A good opportunity.
Very good. Thank you,
thank
Cindy.
You.
All right, Mr. Clerk, David.
Item A2, Certificate of Recognition, Community Cleanup Event, initiating the city's Beautify Goleta program.
All right, this one, is we're going to do this a little differently. Now, who has the certificates? Roger's got them. Councilmember Aceves has been the point person on this for as long as I have been on the city council. And I know he's shown a lot of patience, a lot of consistency in pushing for this, and we already we have had the first opportunity to do the neighborhood cleanup, and we would like to give awards of participation in that, and the council member Aceves is going to advance to the mic and bring you people up, and we will try and give you your due for participating.
Thank you. Before I do that, I just wanted to give you an update of our cleanup effort we had on October 17th. Now, as the mayor said, this project's been in the planning stages for a couple of years. When I first brought it up and entertained the idea, and council took a chance, staff took a chance, and let me read you what the result was from our first effort. I think you'll be impressed. Now, this program, Beautify Goleta, what we did is we went into the neighborhoods and offered the neighbors to empty out all their trash and clean up their yards. And we had roll-offs there from Marburg. And as a result, we collected a lot of bulky items, and then we did street sweepings. So October 17th, we were in Old Town, and we serviced 171 homes. This also included 42 separate vehicle trips. So of the houses in the area, we actually had about a 15% participation, which was pretty good. Thanks to the generosity of Marburg and also the contract we have, which is a good contract, they provided three 40-yard roll-off boxes for that day. And we collected 6.91 tons. And the staff at Marburg estimated that from what we collected, 75% was diversion rate. And then after we collected all that, we had posted the streets, no parking, and we had the street sweepers come in, and they covered 1.7 curb miles, and they collected another 238 pounds of debris. So we had a total of three of our city staff there. We had 11 volunteers, including the mayor pro tem and his son Thomas and myself. And we all rolled up our sleeves and made this happen. But what was most impressive, the total cost at this point for the project, for the one-day event, understanding that Marburg covers the roll-offs, but our actual costs were $688. So it's on the road to being a very successful program. We're going to do it again on November 5th, Saturday, November 5th, from 9 to 1, and it's at Mallard and Alondra. So those council members who want to join, I hope you'll be there with me again. Help us and help the community be great. So I want to thank these people that that helped us with this first event with certificates, and I'll ask the mayor pro tem to join me up as we present them and take a photo out. But I'd like to have come up our environmental services coordinator Edward King, Jose Flores, our lead maintenance worker from streets, Jorge Rodriguez, our maintenance worker, Anthony Rodriguez, Anthony Davila, Rosario Rios, Natalia Rios, Cecilia Herrera, and then from Marburg we have Derek Carlson, who's a business manager, and Brian Borgatello, who's vice president. I have David and Kathy here. Are they here with us? Nope. So we have two representatives, Derek and Brian. So if everybody join me at the podium, I appreciate it. So I have everybody's certificate. Did you guys want to say something on the aftermarket? Because I know he does. Everett. And basically, the certificate's all the same, but a recognition of the City Council of the City of Goleta presenting the certificate recognition, acknowledging Everett King for his outstanding contributions to the Goleta community and assisting with the City of Goleta's first community cleanup event, Beautify Goleta program, which was held on September 17, 2016, and it's signed by the mayor.
Thank you.
Jorge? There's two Jorge. Jorge Flores. You said that I looked up and said, yeah, there's two Jorge. Jorge Rodriguez. And Anthony Rodriguez. And Anthony Davila?
Davila.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I should know better. Rosario Rios. And Natalia Rios.
Thank you.
And Cecilia Herrera. Mm-hmm. And then, who am I missing? Marburg Industries, of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would anybody? Yeah, let's have Derek speak, and then Everett, if you want to say something.
Madam Mayor, members of the council, I would just like to say, Madam Mayor Farr, I would like to say just what a pleasure it was to participate in this cleanup and how well organized it was and what a dedicated staff you have from Everett to everyone that was there. It really went off seamlessly when we came in to participate with the boxes and checking in. Everything was really well organized, and Goleta, as far as all of the areas we service, is a very clean, well-represented city as far as the ownership that the citizenship takes in the beauty of the city and the work that they do in coming out. And this was just another shining example of that. So we were just happy to be a part of it. And it should make everyone in the city of Goleta very proud of this effort and everyone coming together, because it really did go off seamlessly. And again, we're happy to have been a part of it.
Well, thank you for your participation. Warburg always seems to be doing the right thing environmentally, so thank you for that. You and I actually go back 20 years, you know. Did you know that? I used to be with the Mexican radio stations, and I used to come out and pitch you. I can remember one time when you were sitting at your desk, you were taking all these disparate pieces of recycling stuff that you didn't recycle, sending them across the country to see if anybody would take them, and we could send it to them so we could expand what we're recycling here. So I was impressed with you then, and you guys continue to do very well for our community. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. As it was already stated, that first event did go quite well, and we do have our next one scheduled for Saturday. It's a slightly different model that we're trying different things to see what works best in the city. Apparently, we got some good feedback from the last event that we did, and I've already received a number of calls from residents in the service area that will be serviced on Saturday asking questions and about what kinds of things they can bring. So the community is definitely engaged. They are excited about the program, and we look forward to conducting more of these in the years to come. I think after Saturday, we'll take a little bit of a respite for the rainy season, and we'll start planning for a number of events to commence in the spring. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Everett. Someone else from the group going to say something? No, I think Ms. Perotti would like to compliment you.
Well, I want to thank Councilmember Seves. Thank you so much. I know this was an idea of yours like many years ago, and it's finally happened, so it must be really rewarding to see it and have it be such a success. And thank Marburg, and thanks Everett King for all your work and staff. But thank the community for stepping up and getting involved. Thank you so much. And as was mentioned, there will be another Beautify Goleta Day on this coming Saturday from 9 to 1. And I plan on being out there. I'm sorry I missed the last one, but I will be out there. And I encourage others to come, because Old Town is really our town. And so we should all engage in helping clean it up and do helping our community, our neighbors. So see you out there on Saturday. Thank you so much.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, I forgot to mention, I really appreciate Anthony Rodriguez and the CERT volunteers, without which we couldn't have done this program, and they really rose to the occasion. And as you can see, the ones that are here before today are actually going to be on the ground again on Saturday. So there are other volunteer organizations that we'll be tapping, but for these initial events, we couldn't have done it without CERT. So thank you very much for that, Anthony.
Thank you.
Very good. Again, thank you all for your participation. Certainly makes us a stronger community.
Can I say something real quick?
Sure. Can I say something too?
Yeah. Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo would like to add his comments.
Yeah, I just wanted to, again, thank all the volunteers, thank Marburg. I'm glad Anthony got the recognition. You know, he's got a really special relationship with those CERT kids. They really, it seems like they treat him like a second dad out there, and that's wonderful to see. And there was a lot more young people here there that weekend, too. So I want to make sure they get their thanks later, too. There was, I think we had 8 or 9 kids out there, not counting my son. And I guess I should thank Thomas, too, in case he's watching on TV somewhere. He was out there with me, too. It was a great event. We had one guy show up like five different times. He started going to his neighbor's house with his truck and loading up their junk and bringing it over to us. And so we cleaned out, one guy cleaned up probably four or five houses for us. All in all, really, and Everett, again, great job. Everybody got their hands dirty, pitched in, and there was nobody just standing around watching. We were all grabbing stuff out of trucks and loading it up. It went really well. Thank you, guys. You did great work.
Anybody else? Well, again, thank you, Councilmember Aceves, for your perseverance here. All right, we'll move on to the consent calendar now. Mr. Kataya, if you would.
Item B1, approval of the City Council meeting minutes of October 18, 2016. Item B2, award of tree trimming and maintenance services contract. Item B3, Hollister Avenue Bridge replacement cooperative work agreement with the State of California. And item B4, professional services agreement with Phoenix Engineering for the Hollister widening project from Stork Road to 280 feet west of South Glen Annie Road, South Stork Widening, Villages at Los Caneros, off-site public improvements, and Recon Palms, off-site public improvements.
Caught me with a mouthful of chocolate. Okay, is there anybody, any council member who wants to pull something from the consent agenda? No, is there a motion?
I move approval.
Second?
I'll second it, then how's that?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Passes unanimously. Okay. Now I'm looking forward to this next one, if you would, Mr. Kataya.
Item C1, findings of the La Patera Over Undercrossing Feasibility Study.
Okay, we're going to feel, or I am going to feel my way along on this. I've got the city attorney keeping me under close watch here, so let me read this. My house is within 500 feet of the edge of this proposed project. According to the Political Reform Act, that creates a potential conflict of interest. Therefore, I will not participate from the dais in this item. Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo will chair the meeting for this item. I do wish to speak on this item as a resident, so at this time, I will leave the dais and remain in the chambers until the public comments portion of the meeting. After that, I am called on to speak. I will leave the chambers for the balance of the item. Mayor Pro Tem.
Okay. And I wanted to, again, confirm with, and we talked about this briefly, I am outside, I know, and I only bring it up because I live close to where our mayor lives, I am outside of the 500-foot limit.
That is correct. We did review the radius map from your property to the project area. And your property is more than 500 feet from any portion of the project area as currently proposed.
Great. Okay. Just for those of you who know where I live, you know we did look at it, and I am outside the limit. So I think we'll begin with the staff report from Ms. Gaglione.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem, members of the council. I'm here today to report out on the results of the La Patera over or undercrossing feasibility study. So the purpose of the project obviously would be to provide vehicle, bicycle, and pedestrian access across Highway 101 and the railroad. We have so few crossings in the city. This would begin at North La Patera Lane and at South La Patera Lane, and it would enhance the transportation grid by providing that alternate route for vehicles, bicycles, and peds. It provide an alternate route for residents, businesses, and emergency vehicles, and reduce congestion at Los Carneros and Fairview Avenue interchanges by providing a route for local traffic. So everyone probably knows where this is, but as you can see, I've laid out, there's Highway 101 and Union Pacific Railroad. 101, Union Pacific Railroad. I show La Patera Lane as a solid green line, but that's more just to show where they do line up, even though they're sort of cut, separated by the railroad and by the Union Pacific Highway 101. In the lower left corner, you see the Direct Relief International parcel. So this feasibility study was just completed last month, like the last week of last month, by Drake Hagelin and Associates. There are two possible recommended alignments, and each alignment could be constructed as an under or over crossing. Right now, only the overcrossing is recommended. And although I didn't call that out specifically in the staff report, the alignment would be the same, whether you're going over or under, because you still need time to either get over and then come back down or get under and then come back up. So why the undercrossing isn't recommended? The tunnel in some places would not be deep enough to bore conventionally. You need, given the soil type, you need a certain depth to be able to bore without disturbing the soil above. So it would need to be constructed using cut and cover, which means opening the ground up and building that top down and then covering that up again, which would lead to extended construction times and extreme disruption of Highway 101 and Union Pacific Railroad. Also, the tunnel could be inundated in a 100-year storm. So we see the firm maps in the lower right-hand corner in the red circle that shows the project, which is within the limits of what would be inundated in a 100-year storm. And this is just the next panel because it sort of overlaps where you see the same project, the same area. Other reasons are high maintenance costs. So since it can be inundated, you're going to have some pumps and then an exterior detention facility built. You have to ventilate something that long. You also have to have a fire suppression system and lighting. Potential safety concerns for personal safety. It's interesting because in much shorter runs in other communities, we've had parents be concerned about letting their kids use that or have, you know, women bicycle even because no one can see them from outside of the tunnel. And then the cost. The undercrossing option is estimated to cost 3 to 5 times as much as the overcrossing option. So our alignment alternatives. Each alignment alternative forms a new intersection with Shamrock Avenue and La Patera Lane. Each alignment option has a 30-mile-per-hour design speed. And the typical section would have 2 12-foot-wide travel lanes, a 10-foot-wide sidewalk on the west side for peds going in either direction. Next to that sidewalk would be 5-foot Class 2 bike lane. And then on the east side, where there is no sidewalk, you'd have a 7-foot-wide Class 2 bike lane. So this is alignment one, and this would come through slash over the DRI parcel, beginning at that new intersection with Shamrock and coming around. The reason this is so long, I mean, intuitively you think we can just go straight across and the two streets line up. But in order to get up and over, you need that length. Right now, slopes are the steepest slope is about 9%. Now, normally for ADA, you go 8.33%, but if it's attached to a road, you're able to go steeper. If we were to shave that down further, you'd be making the loop even larger. So the alternative one, it curves over the DRI parcel. It ties into the intersection of La Patera and Shamrock Avenue, creates that new stop-controlled intersection. Traffic in all directions can use the proposed overcrossing. It maintains access to businesses, the Amtrak station, and La Patera Lane from all directions and has the least impact to South La Patera Lane. So going back to it, as you can see, no matter if you're coming up the street this way, I mean, you can still go right by and get to the Amtrak station. It's easy to get from the station and go to the overcrossing. There's no impacts to those businesses, which in that area, a lot of them, there's truck traffic, so they need to get in there. So this option doesn't interfere with that. And this shows how at the touchdowns, you'd have the MSE walls, and it would be a cast-in-place pre-stress girder bridge. DHA briefly looked at precast, but given the curves and things that have to be used to build this bridge, it would be difficult to do it with precast and be more expensive. So at this time, that's what they're recommending. So alternative two touches down on South La Patera. It still ties into the same intersection to the north, but it pushes into existing lanes on South La Patera Lane. It has more impact to the access to the Amtrak station, commercial businesses, and to circulation. It would require some removal of on-street parking and potentially sidewalks. It requires a U-turn to get from the overcrossing to the Amtrak station as designed now. I mean, we could look at making changes. Would heavily impact South La Patera Lane and Lindmar Drive intersection. It has the most impacts to South La Patera Lane and businesses there. So as you can see, this one would bring you down, touch down here, and then what, if you want to get to the Amtrak station, you sort of have to maybe whip a U-turn, maybe you would have to widen the street there. It would obviously be difficult for trucks to service those businesses with that touchdown. So it's more likely that that would require more of a more reconstruction of the area to make it work. So our estimated total project costs, we look at alternative one, which is the one that loops through the DRI building. Engineering and design, the same for both, about $3.5 million, and the undercrossing. Right of way, about $1 million. We didn't estimate right of way for the undercrossing at this time. You'd have a lot more temporary impacts, and you'd have to get, there'd be more impacts under 101 and also UPRR. So the right of way would be considerably more expensive. Construction for the alternative one is $20 million, and that assumes purchase of the DRI parcel. Alternative two at $22 million, and the undercrossing somewhere between $60 and $100 million. All told, the total estimates, these would range from $24 to $26 million, a couple million more for alternative two, and $73 to $113 million for the undercrossing. Now, alternative two that touches down right on South La Patera, we haven't fully vetted all of those other right-of-way impacts to local businesses, what's going to happen to circulation, other things that might happen to the road. That would require, we'd have to really look at that. These costs also don't take into account some of the utility relocation that will have to take place. So basically, the undercrossing options would be expensive and disruption, leaving the overcrossing options as more viable or perhaps more attractive. Alternative one has the cleanest connections and the lowest cost, but that's assuming the DRI parcel is purchased. Otherwise, you would increase those costs. And alternative two is a low-cost option if the DRI parcel will not purchase, but it has to be determined what the cost would be relating to the traffic circulation and business impacts. So the feasibility study recommends the alternative one overcrossing and the structure type being a cast-in-place, pre-stressed structure with the mechanically stabilized retaining walls. Funding sources, potentially, some money can come from the GTIP, the GLIDA Transportation Improvement Program, the UCSB Long Range Development Plan, or the LRDP, General Fund, and grants. Next steps, if Council wanted to move forward on this, would be a project study report, which would cost approximately $600,000 and take about 18 months, and creating a funding plan or more fully explore options or come back to Council for further direction. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Gaglione. Ms. Gaglione, sorry. Does Council have any questions? Go ahead, Mr. Seves, Councilman Seves.
Okay. We have another bridge planned for on the west end. Is that fully funded?
No, that is not.
Okay. How much short are we there? Do we know?
$10-12 million.
Okay.
Maybe more.
You talk about potential funding sources. Our GTIP program has already been planned out, basically. Our LRDP has already been planned out, supposedly. So if we start taking from those programs, then we're going to be taken away from another program that we're already planning on.
Yes, Council Member Seves, there is some money in the LRDP for this, and this is listed in the GTIP, so it remains to be seen what eventually the total funding that we will get and all of the different projects that we have to build, how that plant lays out.
I guess my concern is that with the other bridge not being fully funded, and you're asking for another $24 million that we, or 24 to 26 that we don't have, kind of wondering why we should be moving forward on it. The other question I had, though, is, you talk about landing right in the middle of a neighborhood there at Shamrock and La Patera.
Have they been involved in the conversation? Have we had any meetings with them? Were they notified that we were going to talk about this today?
No. Since this is just a feasibility study, it doesn't mean we're doing anything. We're waiting for council direction. If council says we want you to go ahead with this, then, of course, we would start to plan for public, you know, open house type public workshops and make sure that everyone is advised.
But why would we want to move forward if we don't have, if we're not gauging the response from the neighborhood as to whether they even want to have a bridge coming down in front of their house?
The purpose of just doing the feasibility study was just to gather information to bring to council for your consideration. It does not mean that we are moving forward or doing anything else. So it's important to not worry people if council isn't going to want to move forward on this. As soon as we get the nod that this is something you wanted to do, then we, of course, have to reach out to the community. And but unless you, that also takes planning, and there's money involved to prepare for that, and we would need to get deeper into the design to give accurate information to folks. So unless council is going to direct us to move forward on this, we wouldn't start doing public outreach.
Okay. And finally, how much have we spent on this project already?
$31,000,
$32,000. All right, those are my questions.
Okay, any other questions? Councilman Perotti, Councilwoman Perotti.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo. Well, thank you, Councilmember Aceves. Those were a lot of the questions I had as well. I guess my question would be about where is this, if we were looking at this as like at first glance, I'm just kind of wondering where it's at as far as the, if you're looking at it being on a runway, is it behind the Western Bridge, the Western Bridge on the western end of Goleta would be moving forward before this, correct?
Yes, Councilmember Perotti, absolutely. We do need to finish that, you know, finish what we started. I think what makes this discussion timely is if the city is considering that purchase of that parcel, then incorporating this structure would need to be thought of now.
No. I support the idea of a second bridge. I just, seeing the need being greater on the western end at this point in time and knowing that we've already done a lot of work as far as community outreach and so I just kind of trying to put it into perspective of where it fits as far as this moving forward with this. And this would be something that I would agree would have to have community workshops just like the other bridge has had over the years. I do have a quick question when I was reading through it, though, on the grade 9%, and you said it does meet ADA compliance, but can you tell me, I don't really know what that exactly means, but will that be more difficult for somebody in a wheelchair navigating? Is that something they can do on their own, or say your average biker? Is that, just out of curiosity, what does that mean, that 9% grade?
Yeah, so that's 9 feet over 100 feet.
Okay.
If you look at what is considered the maximum under ADA for access ramps is 8.33%. So it's not that much more.
Okay.
But we need to try to keep it as low as we can.
Yeah. Okay. I think that was questions I had. And we could, if we wanted to, I'm not saying that we would, we could take money from the long-range development plan from the university and for this bridge, La Patera, and put it all into the western bridge. If we wanted to, if council were to choose that so that we'd move forward more quickly with one versus the other.
Yes, if council were to choose that, all we have to do is send a letter to UCSB asking that they make that change.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
They could do that.
All right. Thank you.
Councilman Bennett?
Yes. I just bring back some memories of the council. We did move forward on this feasibility study because of the ongoing effort to purchase the DRI property. Mm-hmm. And we knew from preliminary comments made from our Public Works Department that it would, in fact, to some degree or another, without being studied, going to have an impact on that parcel. Mm-hmm. So that's why we went forward with the feasibility studies, so that we could determine at first blush what type of impact this might be. Plus, it's covered in our general plan and says this is what the city shall do in the future and plan for and provide the necessary capital money to go forward. I'm always a firm believer in having a project at the point of putting it in a three-ring binder and put it on the shelf. I recognize certainly we don't have the money to construct the project, but doing a further preliminary study to get it to the point where we would be eligible for grants in the future or federal funding. Now, there's been a lot of talk, and we've heard a lot of talk, and I'm going to get deep into it, but that there will be a grand effort put forward by the feds to enhance the amount of federal money that will be available for infrastructure in the coming years. That wasn't done the last time, 8 years ago, when we went into the recession, and it has almost typically been done in any other recession that we've experienced in this country. And so there's a lot of commitments that we're going to do that. There was more money. There was a transportation plan that was put forward that allows for federal funding to go forward for the next 4 years. I believe it's 4 years left. And we learned about that last January. We went to D.C. to find out what additional monies had been allocated. So each and every time, the people that work out best on these things is those that have put forth enough of a preliminary effort to qualify to pursue those grant funds. And I'd like that confirmed by staff.
Oh, yes. The farther along you are, the more competitive you are.
Okay. And we've been incredibly competitive on grants that we've applied for and things that we've tried to go forward. And that would apply to the Western Overpass, which I personally believe is the priority. And we've already got a lot of money and effort put into that, and that needs to be constructed first, and I totally support that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we can't do some of the more preliminary things here to flesh this out, to then put it on the shelf and forget about it to some future date. Some future council would then be in a position to, if federal money were to become available, feeling that it may very well become available, so that it could become competitive rather quickly and go forward. That often is the criteria. So I would surely like to look at this some more and see what the possibilities are. I'm interested more in alternative two as an underpass as opposed to overpass, and I'd like some information on I've never heard of a concept of tunneling before. So I was a bit taken back when I read that, because I was looking for the conventional construction of sidewalls to the roadway and individual bridges that would pass over the underpasses. Any place else in our local community, like in Santa Barbara, where the underpasses go underneath the freeway, That's the normal way. There's no tunneling that's going on, and they go underneath the railroad as well as the freeway. So that's my question, I guess, is where did this tunneling come from?
Well, it's sort of the jack and bore, and you can try to, if it works, you can use a jackbox, and you can move along, you can excavate and move along and then not disturb the highway and the railroad. In this case, there's just not enough, especially on 101, there's just not enough cover to be able to do that. So then you do have to open it up and have long-term detours to get it built.
Okay, well, we just experienced that with San Pedro Creek and Las Vegas Creek, where there were three lanes of bridges in both directions, two separate sets. And if I remember correctly, those cost $16 million.
This is much deeper. So we'd have to have 15 feet of clearance.
No, I get that, yeah. Underneath the bridges as they were constructed.
Right.
So that would be the additional cost, the subterranean construction, mm-hmm. and the sidewalls necessary to hold everything in place for a cut and backfill or whatever
yes.
we call that construction
cut
technique.
Cut and cover, yeah.
Yeah, cut and cover, as opposed to any boring. And I would expect that underpass would be exposed, again, much like our neighbors, where, you know, it's not a tunnel atmosphere. I mean, it's freeway lanes overpass, but there's openings. You can see the sky if you walk through the middle, not on every one of them, but on many of them. and you certainly see the sky on either side of the freeway lanes, mm-hmm. and then you see the bridge overhead with the railroad, and then you come out into the skylight again. So that's why I'm a little confused on when you say this may be unsafe because it's going to be all covered over.
No, Councilmember, not that it may be unsafe, but the feeling that people have of going through this long area where no one from the outside can see you. And this has come up in other projects that I've been involved in other places, that when kids are out of sight, you have a lot of pedestrian undercrossings in different cities that they're locked up for safety. People won't use them. And if people don't use them regularly, other things happen. But, you know, you think of letting kids go on their bicycles underground. Some parents would have an issue with that, especially if you don't have a lot of traffic going through that, so that someone wouldn't be as readily seen. So that's not an engineering determination. That's just a sense and something I think you would flesh out, you know, more in getting public comment. But I've seen much shorter sections where pedestrians didn't want to use them or didn't want their children to use them.
I'm very familiar with what you're talking about. There were many of them down where I came from, and they were locked off, and I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Those were strictly for pedestrians. They were incredibly narrow. They were dark and dank. That's not what's being proposed here. And as I continue to say, I'm a bit confused still, because there's access to the sky in between things. I mean, I wouldn't presume that the right-of-way that's off to the south of the freeway, southbound lanes, is going to be all covered over all the way going underneath the railroad tracks and suddenly see daylight. I mean, to me, that would be incredibly expensive to do that, and it would be open from the time you went to the south of the freeway shoulder. It would be open until you hit the railroad, and it would be closed for that section of the railroad so the tracks could go overhead. And then, I mean, it's no different than the railroad going over Hollister Avenue at the trestle on the very east end of the valley.
Right, so they didn't spend a lot of time on the design on that. You are talking about quite a deep then opening and having to close that off and keep any dirt or anything or rocks from falling in on cars. So I don't know that any openings in that were anticipated.
It doesn't sound like it.
And we do, and maybe not, because we're installing lighting is included as one of the things that we would need to install. So those are the caveats in the report. Not a lot, in looking at the cost differential and then having to maintain sump pumps and ventilation because of the distance, you have to have ventilation and fire suppression systems, that it was 3 to 5 times more expensive. Now, if council wants to have the underground design looked at in a little more detail, that's obvious. That's your prerogative, and we can do that. But right now, those are the only answers I have for you.
Well, I would like you to point out to me any place where there's fire suppression facilities and something of this nature. I would like to have it pointed out, other than Sepulveda Boulevard that goes underneath the LAX runway system that does have ventilation, and I am familiar with that. I'm just having a hard time getting my arms around this thing, as it's this concept that was proposed from the very beginning as a tunnel, and I don't see this as a tunnel. I look for this, if you can put back up on the screen, alternative number 2, for example. There you go. I'm looking at the portion that comes off of Shamrock all the way until you hit Cayo Real as being open. I don't see that as a tunnel. I mean, I never anticipated that, never would have thought that, mm-hmm. number one. And the area that would be bridged would be certainly Cayo Real, and it certainly would be the 3 freeway lanes on either side. And then it would see daylight again, as I pointed out before, where you see all the foliage. It's on the south side. There's a rather wide right-of-way of Caltrans. And then as you bump up to the railroad, they would certainly require that the track would be double track, just as they did for the flood control project. Even though they're running only a single track, they required the county to pay for double track. So
I don't think that was included in the estimate either.
Well, all I'm saying is if it's open, then that's all you're paying for, is that bridging effort, or making it so the bridge can be put in place or a trestle can be set in place. Mm-hmm. And that's just a matter of the abutments being properly constructed to accommodate that. So you wouldn't have that expense of the overhead until they decided they wanted to put that second track. And, of course, then we'd end up having to be obligated to pay for that, because right now they can put a second track and they wouldn't have that additional expense.
Correct.
But I'm saying that was paid for by flood control in two different places, at Las Vegas and at San Pedro Creek. So they double-tracked all that, the construction, the concrete. They didn't actually put track in the second side, but they kept the mainline track, and that went through it. I might add, they accomplished all that in about 18 hours, too, I might add. So it was all precast concrete set in place. So that's why I'm questioning all this, because there's a presumption here, in my opinion, that was put forward, which is not the project that, and I've looked at this thing for an awfully long time and talked to an awful lot of people, and I never envisioned what is being proposed here for the underground.
It was not anticipated that you immediately go into a tunnel. I mean, there's a point at which you get below grade, then and then you're going to go under. We can go ahead. We can bring this back. I note that now I'm not a fire expert, but I note that the report says that the National Fire Protection Association 502, that's where they got the requirement for the fire suppression system. So we can follow
up on that. I'm just asking you to point one out, that's all.
Well, and sometimes, you know, it doesn't matter if they aren't already in a lot of things. Sometimes they change the rules, and then you end up having to go with what's newer. But we can, as I said, if we could ask them to more fully explore the underground option, the undercrossing, and get better estimates. And get, a little more, do a little more on the graphics so that everyone could see exactly where they would daylight and where they wouldn't. This is just a feasibility study. This is the 30,000-foot view on this, just to start to give council something to think about.
Well, my last comment, and the reason I keep coming back to this undergrounding is, I have, in fact, spoken to some of the folks in the neighborhood, and I would hope that they would come forward at some point and talk to us, because their impression of an underground, they didn't have a real problem with that.
Right.
Having a massive structure looking out their front window as they look across to the park wilderness now, that is a concern that people have already expressed, and I shared that concern, and I mm-hmm. said, you know, I think the potential for an underground is feasible, and I, you know, that was off the top of my head. I'm not an engineer, but it just seemed like it could be doable based on other communities and communities very close by that have accomplished that same task of going underneath the freeway and going underneath the railroad. So I heard negative comments in regards to a raised roadway system, but that if it were underground and, you know, the cut was in such a way and side supported so that you could still look across, then that feeling of negativity pretty much went away.
Okay.
Because there's a fair number of people that would love to be able to go across La Patera going to Hollister and miss Fairview and Hollister and miss Los Caneros and Hollister. I mean, those are just easier things for those of us that live in the neighborhood, and I too live in the neighborhood, but much further away. So I'm very familiar with going through here all the time, and I do talk to people that live in the general area that have expressed some thoughts already. So anyway, that's where I'm coming from.
I understand.
Okay. I just had one or two questions, and then we can move on to public comment. The version, alternative one, the one that's being recommended,
yes.
and includes, it looks like, a pretty severe impact to that DRI property. What we can't see from here is, what is the altitude of this bridge as it goes through the property? In other words, are we going to be able to build something if we buy the property, and if we decide to build a train station, will we have the option of building underneath that overpass, or is it already going to be probably too low at that point where we can get away with that?
Yeah, I don't have the elevation difference on the building right now, so that would be something else that we could come back and we can get those numbers for you, how much shadowing. If you if it were, depending on where you wanted to have building and where you wanted to have parking lot, you know, you can make the bridge part of covered parking.
Okay, that's what I was thinking, too, that if we left access so we could get to that back corner, we could make that the parking area, and you somehow walk through. I'm sure there's more than somehow. You can walk under the bridge. Okay. Well, I guess I'll save the rest of my discussion for deliberation here. So I guess now we'll move on to public comment, unless council has any other questions right now. And he didn't fill out a speaker slip, but I believe the mayor wants to make a comment. So I didn't get any other slips, though. No others? Okay. There you go.
And Rihanna was in Las Vegas, and she's a big pop star, and she had an elaborate stage that she was coming down, and she fell as she was coming down, and she picked herself up at the bottom and said, "Now, please don't put that on YouTube." And they said by the time she finished her song, there were two versions already loaded up on it. So I do this with some trepidation. But now, I guess I'm not supposed to comment on anything in the binder. Is that right?
No, you're free to make comments as a member of the public.
Okay, as a member of the public, I like this, of course. I think a lot of citizens view the well-being of our city, depending on how easy it is to get from one place to another. Fairview and Los Carneros, they need a little love, without a doubt. And so the first bridge, by all means, you know, but this one, too, I see. I'm all for this. So, and I should say, if you look at that photo there, my house is right about where the city insignia is, the logo. So, I mean, if it's going to impact anybody, I'm certainly right there. But when I read about it and I think about it, you know, this could help the general flow of traffic in this area. We have a traffic grid that is inadequate for the size of the area and the people that live here. And I think this is something that we should look into the feasibility of it. And let me also say something about the placement of the posts, the pilings that would hold that bridge, that overpass up. Cai Real, I mentioned last time we were talking that Cai Real is something I think we need to figure out some way to connect the portions of that. Give some relief to Hollister 101 at Cathedral Oaks. And so, boy, the shoe's on the other foot.
Well, I have the kill button up here, Mayor, too.
So when if and when we ever build this, but in the feasibility study, on the posts that were near Cai Real, give some thought to putting them far enough to one side so we could expand Cai Real without doing any damage. Anyway, I don't know what the feasibility would show. My colleagues here brought up a question of financing. And that, of course, needs to be explored. The Western Bridge first, but then this one, I'm very much for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so no other speaker slips. I guess now we move on to deliberation. So does anybody want to start with their suggestions?
We need to let Mr. Farr exit the chamber.
Oh. Should we play him some music on his way out or something? Or? All right. Should we wait till we hear the door? Is that what we're supposed to do?
Probably wait till the clerk comes back.
All right. Come on, David, hustle back. Thank you, David. All right. Anybody want to begin the deliberations? We'll go back in order again. Go ahead, Councilman Aceves.
Well, I think it was good information to provide. I'm glad we only spent $31,000. But any design that we feel we need to move forward on
is problematic. And I think if you look at the one that's on the screen now, you're, first of all, you're going to increase the traffic multifold onto North La Patera and Shamrock for vehicles trying to avoid crossing at Los Caneros or Fairview, or Stork for that matter. And La Patera is a highly traveled street, especially bicycles going to La Patera School. Now you're talking about going on to Parkland, and I'm seriously concerned about the amount of work it's going to take to put any project through that piece of property. It's protected, and most importantly, that area has got a very lower elevation. And then you get to deal with Caltrans. And then you get to deal with the railroad. And as we've learned in our trials in this on this council, those aren't two groups that are easy to work with.
Correct.
And especially the railroad. Look what happened here at Los Caneros. That was really problematic trying to work with the railroad people. And then the other thing, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that we don't have the money for this. And I don't want to spend any more money to do any more studies until we get the work that we've already planned done, and that includes our West Bridge. I'd rather put more money into the West Bridge, get that done. If we're looking to use LRDP money or any other funds or grants, I'd rather put it in there than to deviate it and go down to, divert it down to here. So my position would be to full stop at this point with any of the studies.
Okay, thank you. Councilwoman Perotti.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo. I know that we're going to need this bridge eventually, and I do support the idea of another bridge. It is in the general plan. It's been planned for. And I think Councilmember Bennett brought up some really interesting ideas about doing an under bridge, not the over undercrossing. And I thought about it, how I was thinking about how it was going to look to have that over crossing and then into that area where it's just so beautiful there right now. It's a beautiful open space, and I can only imagine what the neighbors would think as well. I support the idea of really focusing on the western ends bridge. We've really done a lot of work on that as well. And, I see the need being so great, especially now with added buildings and population. We've got, that would help the schools on that end. Excuse me, it would help Gersh Park. Shopping. And the other thing that I thought about the other day were the ambulance services. They seems like they're located on Hollister, and typically, I don't know if they always go this way, they always seem to go towards east on Hollister to the Stork, Glen Annie, and hop on the freeway there, where I would think that this, if we did the Western Bridge, it would help them as well. I'm just throwing out ideas. I do support the idea of looking, I guess, I know we're in deliberation, and but I do have a question of what would the next step, if we were to take this to the next step, what would the next step really, would it be looking at the budget? Would it come back with a look at, in more detail, the undercrossing? And probably a budget. How much is that really going to cost? I have to say that I am in support of putting all the money into from long range development plan into one project and get one up and going. But I do support this as well. And so I'm just curious to like where we're at with, if we were move forward, the expense. What are we looking at?
Well, Councilmember Perotti, it really is, the next step is what Council says it's going to be. So if next step were to start on a project study report, we can do that. But if next step is, you know, you want more information, you want to do a little more engineering just to see if the undercrossing is really feasible and to make sure the assumptions are correct, maybe the order of magnitude will be 5 times, maybe it'll be 3 times. That's why they say 3 to 5. They haven't delved into that. But that could be the next step in looking at what a better idea of what those costs might be and getting an idea of what it would look like, where it would come out, and also specifically then where it would come up on the DRI parcel. Would the underground option cannibalize more of that parcel in terms of buildable space than the overcrossing? And I can't tell you that now. So that'd be something for you to decide.
And I like the idea of like having things kind of like not completely shovel ready, but have the design or have it pretty much ready so that we can have a better chance of accessing grant money for it as well.
Yes, and I think the decision of whether we're going over or under would have to be made going into the, you know, once we're going to go in the PSR, project study report process, that's, You're getting pretty deep, and you've usually you'll look at alignment alternatives, but over or under would probably be good to have decided first.
Okay. Well, then I would support moving forward with that information. Thank you.
Councilman Bennett?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from. I'm not looking for a PSR at this stage because I don't have enough information, and I couldn't make the determination of whether over or under would be appropriate today. The number one priority, we've all stated it, we've all restated it, is the Western Overpass. And, you know, we're committed to that. We've got money in Measure A committed to that. So there's no question that that's going forward. And I wouldn't want to jeopardize any funds that we have going forward to complete that project. But we're still at the very front end preliminary stages for this. So, and you haven't been able to give us other than 3 and 5 times, that's a pretty open book. That's not incredibly definitive by any means.
No.
So I would like to have some of the questions that I've raised in regards to the underpass, constructing it in the manner that I've described and using it so that the public that may be watching, that would be the same approach that was used to put the improved creek capacity in. So we've already experienced what it is in the realignment of the freeway and the impact at the railroad. I mean, it would all of that would be similar in nature to what we're dealing with on something like this. And that's what I would be looking for. And that would answer the problem so people, I would like to see a drawing so that those that live along La Patera could see what would be the impact of an underpass, because the presumption is that, you know, you would be able to see over the top of it and you'd be looking straight to the west, and it wouldn't have that impact versus the massive overpass type structure that would be presented in what you have going forward there. Because it would be raised up. You said it would be going
yes.
up. But basically, once you leave Shamrock and La Patera, it's going to be on the upward side. So I would just like some more information. And what would you think it would cost to be able to go forward to flesh that out, flesh out the questions that have been raised?
It could be $50,000. We're going to have to bring surveyors out to do additional surveys. I can come back with the proposal. I mean, council can then choose to award a contract or not award a contract and looking at the scope. And there may be some things that if the price comes in too high that you would say, well, I don't need that right now, but I need this. But what I'm hearing is you want to talk about where you could have openings to daylight. You want to know, you want sort of a visual simulation, if it went underground, what that would look like if you're standing on La Patera looking out. And you would like a better estimate of cost as well. And then I would assume we also would need a good idea of where it would come up on the DRI parcel and how much space would be cannibalized by that.
And I recognize the 15 feet you spoke of earlier in regards to the clear space under the trestle for the tracks.
Okay. Is that it, Councilman Bennett?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I should just complete the set. I also want to see us focus on the Western Bridge first. You know, I should say that, even though I think it's been pretty unanimous. Seeing the alignment for the overhead, which from a cost perspective, I certainly understand why you focused on that, and so that's not a criticism. But seeing how it cuts through Lake Los Caneros is troubling. I mean, that's one of our natural jewels here, and we're going to take it's not a huge chunk, but we're going to take a chunk out of it, that's for sure. And I'm not sure that that's what the public wants. I'm not sure that's what I want. In the same token, I understand where it's, unless the numbers come in drastically different, going underneath seems cost prohibitive. So I think getting some better numbers on that, and again, I understand why you stopped at that point when you saw a $100 million price tag. That's well beyond our ability to pay, short of a lot of federal funding. So I wouldn't mind spending a little bit, and I'm going to say a little bit, of money to try and flesh that out just a little more. I mean, I think at the end of the day, these funds could be better spent, assuming that it doesn't come in drastically cheaper, looking at better options for the Fairview overpass. And you know, I know it's I've had neighbors refer to it as the Great Wall of Fairview, and that's really what we're addressing here is Fairview's a mess. And getting over there is tough, and I know we've probably looked at the redesign there a lot of times, but going back to that and trying to figure out a way to make that work better is probably better money spent, unless these numbers come in drastically different, at least for the short term. And so I don't want us to go overboard really trying to figure out a way to make this work when it can't, and we just have to decide that we'll figure out other ways to improve the traffic flow getting over the freeway. But I do want to see if we can get a better feel for those numbers on the bridge, the undergrounding of this, and see if there's a better way to make it work. I gotta believe the neighbors would hate the idea of looking out their window and seeing this big bridge, especially in a park that close to where they're at. I can't see it from my house, or I won't be able to see it from my house, but I'm still sympathetic to people that would look out their window that used to be a beautiful park and pretty trees, and now they see this big concrete construction taking cars and people over the freeway. So we do have to be very cognizant of that. But I think you've gotten what you need from us at this point, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And again, just spend a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Okay. So I don't think we need a motion on this one then, right? We're just sending her back with asking for more input. Is that correct, Ms. Green?
We were really just looking for feedback, and okay. We have received that. So I think we have what we need. Thank you.
Okay. So then there's no need to take a vote.
Thank you,
Ms. Gaglione. Gaglione, I think I said that right. So we'll take a short break while somebody goes to get the mayor, and we'll restart in a couple minutes.
The afternoon session of the Goleta City Council is now back in session. Mr. Kutai, if you would.
Item C2, approval of the Resource Recovery Project Material Delivery Commitment and Processing Services Agreement between the County of Santa Barbara and the City of Goleta.
All right, and we have Everett King, our Environmental Services Coordinator, and Rosemary Gaglione, our Public Works Director, informing us about this project. If you would, please.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Everett King, the City's Environmental Services Coordinator. Again, thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation today. The item before you for consideration this afternoon is the Tahigas Resource Recovery Materials Delivery Commitment and Processing Services Agreement between the County of Santa Barbara and the City of Goleta. Staff's recommendation is for your council to authorize the city manager to execute the agreement in substantial conformity with the attached draft, subject to approval by the city attorney. The county and the city of Santa Barbara continue to negotiate some last-minute language revisions to a couple of the agreement's provisions, the final result of which we don't expect will materially change the core provisions of the agreement. Due to the county's anticipated financial closing deadlines, increasing material and labor costs, and the fact that our council will soon have one or two new members with little or no background or understanding of the project, the city manager and city attorney concurred with staff that it was desirable to bring the agreement before you at this time. That is, of course, with the understanding that if any material changes do occur in the final language group negotiations between the city of Santa Barbara and the county, that we'll have to revisit that. But again, we don't expect that to be the case. As you know, this has been a long and arduous task to get this project to this stage. The project has taken numerous turns that were not anticipated at the front end of this process when that was started a number of years ago. But those of us who have been laboring quietly on this project for a number of years believe that what we've ended up with is a project that will meet nearly all of the project's original goals, will be beneficial to our communities, and will bring our regional solid waste management system into the 21st century. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is begin by providing a brief project background. I know that many of you have sat through updates through the years and are generally familiar with the project, but I would like to focus just on some of the more salient milestones that have occurred over the last 7 or 8 years. And then I'll focus a little bit on the agreement and its particular provisions and what that means for the city. Before I get started, though, I'd like to acknowledge Mr. Mark Schleich, who's the Deputy Director of the County's Resource Recovery Waste Management Division, and Ms. Leslie Wells, who is the Collection of Materials Manager for the division. And they are available to answer any questions or address any concerns that I cannot adequately respond to at the conclusion of my presentation. You seem to have some...
There we go.
Okay, thank you. Okay, where this got a start was at the turn of the century, actually turn of the millennia, when you think about it, when the County Board of Supervisors approved an expansion of the Tahigas landfill. That expansion process turned out to be much longer, more expensive, and much more controversial, I think, than any of us thought that it would be when we started at the front end of that. And as a result of that, when the board did approve the current expansion of the Tahigas landfill, they directed staff to look into exploring alternatives to continued landfilling, with the recognition that landfilling probably isn't the most desirable way to treat our waste stream. And so as a result of that, very soon after, what was called a multi-jurisdictional solid waste task group was formed. And this was a group that consisted of elected officials and staff from the county and all of the incorporated cities within the county, as well as some of the special districts. And the purpose of the group was to really drill down and get a full understanding of what the state of the solid waste management system was at the time and where we could take it going forward into the future. And early on, that group came up with a set of guiding principles that I think are useful to just recap. So they wanted to retain local control. And again, at the time, elected officials were very clear that they wanted a solution for our solid waste management that would be handled within the county. They didn't want to go down the road of exporting waste outside of the county. At the time, there were a number of mega landfills that were being proposed, and it seemed like an attractive option. But again, at the time, the elected officials that were part of this effort decided that's not what we wanted. We wanted to retain control of the waste stream and have a system that was essentially within the bounds of the county. We wanted regional services. Many of our communities share recycling programs and other approaches for solid waste management, and so we wanted to continue with regional cooperation. And what that ultimately led to was a waste shed centric approach, where the Santa Maria and the Lompoc waste sheds decided that they were going to pursue certain approach to solid waste management going forward, and then the Tahigas waste shed on the south coast opted to pursue a conversion technology project, which we'll explain a little bit more in a second. Waste diversion obviously is a very important element. Even with well-heeled populace and 30 years of innovative and aggressive recycling programs on the south coast, we find that there is still a considerable amount of recyclable materials that are being disposed of in the landfill. And that would include both the traditional recyclables, cans, bottles, paper, as well as organic materials that can now be recovered and put to better or higher use than burying them. We wanted to achieve economic efficiencies and to consolidate system elements where possible. And then we wanted reliability. Whatever system we ended up with, it had to be something that could be counted on to work, that used technology that was proven, And then finally, we wanted to retain flexibility in that any new solid waste management system needed to be able to handle a multiple of waste streams. So following on those, that group, the Multi-Jurisdictional Solid Waste Task Group, and I think Michael was a part of that from essentially the beginning, they did work for about 3 or 4 years, and then the effort kind of was put on a hiatus around 2005, 2006. And it wasn't very long after that that, at least on the South Coast, the idea of pursuing a conversion technology facility was resurrected. And with that, a project team was put together, consisting of staff from the county and the cities of Santa Barbara, Goleta, Solvang, and Builton, to explore the possibility of designing and building and operating such a facility on the South Coast that would serve the Tahigas Watershed. And what we've ended up with is a project that, again, will implement a modernized solid waste management system that's going to provide a cost-effective 20-plus-year regional waste management system. There is a state requirement that jurisdictions identify and manage 15 to 20 years of either processing or disposal capacity within their system. And so this project will meet that goal. And I would like to point out that the plus after the 20 is we fully expect that at the end of the 20-year project life, that this facility will still be operable. It will be replaced going forward throughout the 20 years. And so what we won't end up with is a facility that's this old and decrepit, but one that has been maintained and is modernized. And so we expect that facility to be able to continue to operate well beyond the 20-year the period that we're looking at. It will significantly reduce the need to continue disposing of refuse in landfills, obviously. And a result of that will be to extend the current permitted life of the Tahigas landfill. Landfills are very expensive and complicated to permit, and if we can get as much of the existing airspace out of the current landfill under the permit that it's under, then the better. And then, of course, we want to enhance the recovery of recyclable materials. Again, these are the cans, bottles, paper, items like that. They're, for whatever reason, residents are still disposing in the trash, as well as the organic materials, which will be processed, again, for beneficial reuse. Producing clean, renewable energy, again, as you probably recall, one element of the facility will be generating a biogas that it can turn a generator and produce electricity, and so that will be a net benefit from the project. And then we want to achieve substantial reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. This is a very important element of the project, which I'll touch on a little bit more a little bit later. But this project, if it actually gets built, will probably be the single biggest thing that the county and any of the jurisdictions can do to address greenhouse gas generation within the county, at least for the foreseeable future. So again, just to remind the council, and again, they've seen this before, but what the project consists of is a state-of-the-art material recovery facility, or a MRF as it's sometimes referred to. And this is designed to process the mixed and source-separated material. Mixed would be the refuse that people are throwing away. The source-separated material are the residential recyclable materials that residents are putting into the can. That's currently being processed at a facility in Ventura. And at the front end of this project, it wasn't envisioned that this facility would handle that waste stream. But very quickly, as we were reviewing the proposals, it occurred to us that if we're going to build a MRF here locally, why wouldn't we then use that same facility to process our source-separated recyclables rather than continuing to send them down to this facility in Ventura? So that's one substantial change from the original project to what we are ending up with today. And then, as I mentioned, the second component is the anaerobic digestion unit. This will take the organic materials that are taken out of the waste stream, as well as source-separated materials that are collected as part of food scrap collection programs in the city of Santa Barbara, as well as the county and city of Goleta. And again, it's estimated about 30% of what's currently being buried would be recoverable and would be subject to being further processed in this facility. And then, of course, what you get out of the back end of this facility is a material called digestate. Once all the biogas potential is been achieved, then the material is further processed, refined, and cured, and ultimately can be used as a soil amendment product in agriculture, although it may take a little bit of time to get it to a state where that can occur. And again, I'll elaborate a little bit more on that going forward. What that leaves us with then will be about 40% of what's currently being buried will still need to be landfilled. But again, that will greatly extend the current permitted life of the landfill. as well as recover all these materials that are currently being buried. So that's kind of the overall, the project itself and what it entails. Since we started this process, again, we had identified some initial goals for the project. The state has issued a number of mandates or legislative actions that this project actually will help meet. The biggest of those, of course, was AB 32, the greenhouse gas reduction requirement. And as I mentioned, this project is a major component of all the locally adopted climate action plans, including our own, because it's estimated that once it's in full operation, that it will remove the greenhouse gas equivalent of about 22,000 vehicles on the roadway each year. So that's a pretty substantial reduction. And again, what's being captured here is methane, which is different from carbon dioxide, but it's a very aggressive greenhouse gas that's generated when you bury organic materials. And landfills, turns out, are one of the larger generators of methane in the country, and they're therefore a very important source of greenhouse emissions that need to be controlled. Just a few other legislative actions that have followed, mostly coming out of AB 32, were the mandatory recovery of business recyclables. Now we also have a requirement to divert organics from commercial businesses. That would be restaurants and other food service or food processing facilities. And the way that's structured is it's slowly ratcheting down in terms of thresholds that a business is generating that is subject to this requirement. But ultimately, all the organics are going to be pulled out of the waste stream. And where the state seems to be going with this is to really essentially a ban on landfilling organics, again, because of the generation of greenhouse gases that result from that. And then finally, there's once they passed mandatory organic processing law, they kind of came to the realization that there's really a paucity of processing facilities within the state. And so a lot of communities now are scrambling to try to find ways to process their organic wastes. But this last piece of legislation, again, similar to a landfill, requires jurisdictions to plan for 15 years of organic processing infrastructure. And that's a big part of what this facility will do for us. Currently, there's only one permitted composting operation in the county. That operation, I think, is probably getting close to its capacity. I don't think it would be able to handle all the organics that would come out of this facility in any case. But so anyway, just to point out that there are some additional mandates now that have come down that this project will help us meet. All right. Just briefly, some of the more important milestones over the years. Again, in 2007, a feasibility study was conducted by the county with the cooperation of the cities of Goleta, Santa Barbara, Buellton, and Solvang, who've been involved with this process for the last several years. Following that feasibility study, a project team was formed, again, consisting of staff from those jurisdictions that have been working on this ever since. In 2009, a request for proposals based on the project goals were approved by the County Board of Supervisors and the city councils, including your council. And that was released to the public. That generated a number of proposals that were submitted, five proposals in total from four vendors. And during 2010 and 2011, the project team spent a considerable amount of time and effort really reviewing these proposals for completeness, but also for just the basic financial and operational feasibility. Are these things for real? And at the end of that process, the project team recommended and the Board of Supervisors selected Mustang Santa Barbara Investors, LLC, hereafter referred to as MSB, as the preferred vendor and directed county staff to proceed with the environmental review of MSB's proposal. And then the public participants toward the end of 2012 approved what was a non-binding term sheet, if you recall. And this kind of laid out the general parameters for negotiations with MSB and awarded MSB the exclusive right to negotiate the proposed facility for a limited term. Then throughout the years 2013 and 2014, the project team again continued to evaluate in greater detail the technical and financial feasibility of the selected project, went through multiple pro farmers looking at different variations of the project's design, operation, and financing. So for instance, I mentioned earlier that the idea of processing our source-separated recyclables occurred to us during this process. And so that was one of the changes that we incorporated as we went forward. A draft environmental impact report was developed and released to the public for comment. That was quite a piece of work that involved a lot of technical studies. They wanted to make as bomb-proof an EIR as could possibly be done. As part of that effort, there were a couple of alternative sites for the project that were examined almost to a project level, and in both cases it turned out that there would be unmitigable environmental impacts, or it was otherwise deemed to be politically infeasible to locate these facilities in those alternative locations. So that didn't end up going anywhere. And then towards the end of 2014, the public participants and MSB and its team entered into a series of rather intensive negotiations to really get down to the particulars of the service agreement that would govern the operation of this facility. And unfortunately, at the end of that process, we were not able to come to an agreement or see a path to a project that would meet the RFP and term sheet objectives. So at that point, we kind of put the process on a little bit of pause, and we reassessed where we were at with the process and the project proposal. And at some point towards the end of 2015, the county started looking at the possibility of financing this thing publicly versus a private financing. And again, I didn't really cover it at the beginning, but originally this was proposed to be a public-private project. And at the front end of this, the public participants didn't really feel that they had an appetite to take on a lot of risk. And we saw at the front end of this a lot of risk. And so we wanted the private investors to take that risk on. Well, it turned out that it was going to be too expensive for them to do that. It resulted in a tipping fee that we didn't think was supportable. And also, it wasn't able to, as I point out, meet some of the project goals. So the idea of publicly financing this thing with revenue bonds started to take hold. And again, as we, over the years, were looking at this project, becoming more familiar with it, the idea of assuming some of these risks that early on seemed like, you know, we don't want to do that, became a little bit more maybe palatable or acceptable, the idea that maybe we could take on some of those risks with certain protections in place. So where that left us then is that the county reassessed, now that the county was thinking about assuming the risk, we went another reassessment of the technology performance, marketing, and financial risks associated with the project, had a number of third-party consultants again take a look at the facilities with respect to, you know, are these feasible, are they in line in terms of the costs that were being proposed, and in both cases, with both facilities, the MRF and the AD facility, the answer was that yes, this does seem to be in line with what other facilities look like and what they've cost. So in July, the county staff brought to the Board of Supervisors a packet that included the final subsequent EIR for the project. And again, following public comment and approval of the EIR, it turned out that there were no legal challenges, whereas we thought that was possibly a risk that we were looking at, that might delay the project, but it turned out not to be so. Also, the Board of Supervisors at that time approved the waste services contract between the county and MSB. And again, that's the contract that governs the management and operation of these facilities. And then the county directs staff to move forward with drafting the material delivery agreement that's in front of you today, and with the idea that the city councils would consider and approve those by the end of the current calendar year. And again, that's largely driven by the need to move forward with the closing of the financing, issuing the bonds. As I mentioned earlier, material costs have risen, and labor costs have risen as well, and so we don't want to delay this unnecessarily any further. So again, just briefly about public financing. Again, the county decided that they were going to take the risk for this. And as part of that, they wanted to assess what some of these risks were. So we'll just cover those briefly here. The biggest one is probably the commodity values risk. What that means is, you know, the commodity markets for the recycled materials are very volatile. They've never been stable. They go up, they go down, depending on a variety of factors. The other thing about the recyclables revenue is that this is maybe the biggest source of revenue from the project is going to be generated from the sale of these commodities. There are some other external risks that need to be considered, the things that are generally beyond our control. These would be things like changes in law. The example that's shown here is the so-called green fence. This is the tightening of standards on the part of the Chinese government in the last couple, 3 years, where they've really tightened contamination thresholds for what is being shipped over there. And as a result of that, some of the material was no longer able to be shipped there, and that created a challenge for commodity markets. So those are some of the risks that we've been able to identify associated with the commodity value. The way those risks are being mitigated in this project, well, the biggest one is we're already pretty much riding that roller coaster on the commodity sales. Right now, the county is taking the source-separated recyclables that residents are putting in their cans, shipping that down to Ventura. Gold Coast takes a percentage for processing, and then the revenues that are realized after that are going back to the county and then to the cities of Santa Barbara and Goleta. Because we are contributing that, we get a share based on the tonnage. So we're already taking that risk. So there's nothing new here in terms of that aspect of it. We've discussed putting together a jurisdictional rate stabilization fund that will be created, and that will help us to smooth out the peaks and valleys and leave us with a more stable rate. It'll help us deal with some of the market fluctuations. And really, in most cases, as it says here, this is really a cash flow challenge and not necessarily an economic challenge to the project as a whole. Moving on, there's a risk associated with the digestate. Again, this is the material that's coming out of the anaerobic digestion facility. There is a contamination risk. This would be small pieces of plastic, inert materials, stones and whatnot. Glass in particular is a problem for composting facilities. And it makes this material less attractive to use on agriculture applications. Farmers don't like to see glittering pieces of glass in their field, and so that's a real challenge. There are stricter regulations coming down or being considered for land application of a digestate and similar materials, and there's always the possibility that there will be future restrictions on land application of that material. And this could end up requiring some additional equipment or costs to meet standards. And again, the way that these risks are going to be mitigated, well, first of all, the material that's going to be processed in the anaerobic digestion facility represents about 10% of the total material that's going to be processed at this facility. So it is a very small component, and therefore we don't believe that it presents much of an economic risk to the project or the project participants. The vendor, Mustang, will have a financial penalty for any digestate that has to be landfilled, either because it's not marketable or for some other reason. And then there may be some post-processing things that we can do. These would be employing trommels or screens or other pieces of equipment that can, again, remove contamination to the necessary level that's required. One last thing I'll say about the digestate, although I didn't mention it in this slide. Right now, the material that's coming out of the anaerobic digestion has been assigned a negative value. We're expecting that this, at the beginning, will not be palatable or necessarily marketable. We're going to have to develop the markets for the material. We're going to have to do a little bit of back-end tweaking with the process and equipment to get it to the point where it's clean enough and it can be acceptably applied by farmers on their fields. Finally, there's a performance risk. What happens if this thing just doesn't work? Facility fails to meet performance specifications. So there are in the service agreement with the contractor a number of performance requirements, performance standards. The biggest one, of course, is a 60% diversion rate. And if you recall from the earlier slide, we were expecting to recover about 30% traditional recyclables, about 30% organics from the currently disposed waste stream. And so there's that threshold that the vendor will need to meet. There are additional costs that might be needed to meet specifications, and we're not sure what those could be. Mitigating factors, again, for this particular risk would be the construction and performance bonds. So the construction company that's been identified to do the major foundational and vertical work is Diani up in Santa Maria, and they, as part of their contract, have posted a construction bond that will essentially cover the entire cost of the facility. So if they build the thing and the day after it's built, it's completed and an earthquake levels it to rubble, then we have a bond to draw on to rebuild the facility. Similarly, if it turns out that the roof is 1 foot lower than it otherwise needed to be to accommodate the equipment that's going to be going in there, again, the construction bond would cover any modifications that would be needed in a situation like that. Believe it or not, things like that do happen in these facilities. It's quite a surprise for planners when that happens, I'm sure. There are liquidated damages specified throughout the service agreement if the vendor is not able to meet performance specifications.
Bless you.
And there's a protocol also outlined for a compliance plan and the allocation of costs if there is a change in conditions that are beyond our control that would somehow require a change or a modification in the way that the facility is built or operated, then there's a process to address that. So again, with the county taking on the substantial risk of financing this, these are some of the assessment of risks that came out of that, and I think we all at this point feel fairly comfortable with that. One of the meetings or a couple meetings that I attended were with the risk managers for the city, Santa Barbara and the county. It was very eye-opening for me. I had no idea that there were so many different types of insurance coverages out there, but they had quite an extensive discussion, and they, I think, came up with a package of insurance requirements that the vendor and the subcontractors will be required to carry that we feel will provide adequate protection for the public participants if something goes awry. All right, well, anyway, that's a little bit a background. Again, there's a lot more to this, as you've heard over the years in previous updates, but just briefly now, some of the specifics of the agreement that you're being asked to consider today. Okay, so the term of this, again, is for approximately 22 years. As I noted earlier, this is a 20-year project. The agreement would terminate on December 31st, 2038. There's a two-year construction period included in that allows for the facility to be built and then for startup and acceptance testing before it's opened up for full operation, and that would be for a 20-year period. Again, as I noted earlier, we would expect the facility to continue to be useful beyond that initial 20 years. The agreement's effective date is on the date of the execution by the last of the cities. Currently, I think the city of Santa Barbara is looking at December to bring this to their council, but we're trying to get these material delivery agreements finalized by the end of this year so the county can move forward with its bond financing requirements. Okay, under the agreement, there are a number of county obligations that are outlined. So what this agreement does is it obligates the county to receive, process, treat, and or dispose all the acceptable materials from the city. These would be our franchise collected waste, both residential and commercial, as well as self-haul waste that's currently taken up to the county transfer station. Under the agreement, the county essentially covers all the important aspects of this project, from planning to administration to construction, oversight, operation, maintenance, management, financing, and contract work. So that's all going to be borne by county solid waste staff. The county is going to convene an annual meeting with the public participants under this agreement, and the purpose of that would be to discuss and review any technological, economic, regulatory changes in the collection, source reduction, or processing and disposal that may have arisen over the course of the agreement year, as we're going to call it. And then ensure services are provided by the county and service contractor that are adequate, effective, and economical. So this is an opportunity annually for us to kind of get together and assess how this is going. Okay, under the city's obligations, essentially this is a flow agreement is what it is. It's committing our flow or a minimum annual tonnage of our residential and commercial refuse, recyclables, and organics to the project for the project term. So the franchise agreement that we currently have with Marburg does give the city the authority to direct where the waste is taken. And so we believe that that's covered. We may want to tighten that up and specifically name this project at some point. And then, as I mentioned, refuse and recyclables that are self-hauled by city residents and businesses are captured at the County South Coast Recycling and Transfer Station, and those would, of course, be transferred to the facility for processing as well. So I mentioned there's a minimum annual delivery requirement. For the city of Goleta, that's 28,292 tons annually. And then there's a maximum annual delivery allowance of 34,500 tons. The facility itself is designed to handle up to, I think it's about 240 or 250,000 tons annually. And right now we're looking at about 190, 195,000 tons that are currently being generated. So there's some room there for growth, and as we all know, the city of Goleta is growing. We are bringing on a number of several hundred housing units in the next couple of years, and so that's going to increase the amount of waste that we're generating. But these minimum annual delivery requirement, the maximum allowance, are based on historical data. The county has kept very careful records of all the waste that comes in from all the jurisdictions. And actually, if you look at the last 5 years, the city of Goleta has been the most stable in terms of the number of tons that we've been generating annually. So we feel fairly comfortable with these thresholds. And then it's just summarized here in a table. So again, it's broken out in terms of mixed waste, source-separated recyclable materials, and source-separated organic materials. And that's either food waste or a combination of food and green waste. And then you get these totals here. For the project, again, we've got this minimum annual delivery that the participating jurisdictions will bring to the facility. That's deemed necessary because in order to generate the necessary revenues and to make this thing economical, it has to process a certain minimum amount of tonnages. That's where that comes from. And what happens when one jurisdiction is a little bit under its annual delivery, there's the possibility of sharing with other jurisdictions. So if, for instance, the city of Goleta 1 year was 1,000 tons under its annual delivery requirement, and the city of Santa Barbara was 5,000 tons over, then it's taken as a whole. And so there's a possibility of kind of sharing tons there. So we don't really expect to see any penalties for not delivering the minimum or concomitantly delivering over the maximum deliverable allowance. Okay, there would be under the contract an annual reconciliation process. At the end of each agreement year, as we're calling it in the contract, the county would perform a reconciliation to see if rates require to be adjusted or if there's surplus income that needs to be distributed back to the cities. An annual settlement process will be provided 45 days within the end of the agreement year, and that statement includes some of the items listed here, an accounting of all the tons delivered by type, any revenues the contractors allocated the city, a statement of any necessary contributions to the rate stabilization fund that may need to be made, and then identifying the excess reserves that may be owed to the city. And a little bit more about that jurisdictional rate stability fund. So this is designed and intended, again, to moderate price fluctuations in the commodity markets and to achieve rate stability over the agreement year so that we're not having to constantly adjust the tipping fee and therefore the collection rates to account for some of these fluctuations. And the goal is to charge this fund up to $3 to $3.5 million. That is going to be funded initially through a tipping fee increase that will be effective next July, and I'll explain that here shortly. And then thereafter, it would be replenished or charged with revenues that come back to the public participants from the sale of commodities. I've got a series of diagrams here that kind of explain much of what I've already indicated, but this, again, is primarily a flow agreement between the city and the county. As you see here, the ratepayer provides the waste and recyclables to the waste hauler, who then takes it to the facility. Again, the franchise agreement already provides the city the ability to direct this flow. What's different here is that we don't currently have a formal agreement to bring our waste to Tahigas. We're just taking it there now. This would commit us to this facility again for the next 20 years or so. On this slide, I just want to note that it says up there under city franchise agreement sets rates charged by the hauler. It is common for a lot of jurisdictions to set their own rates, but in our case, we have the hauler, Marburg Industries, is setting the rates for the city following a formula that's specified in the agreement that caps it at a not-to-exceed amount every year. So the ratepayer, again, is the ultimate source of funding for this program. There will be no city revenues needed to contribute towards the building or operation of this. And the cost of the disposal is a small fraction of the trash bill, and I'll explain that a little bit later when we talk about, well, what are the potential impacts to our ratepayers from this facility. Again, the income for the project is mostly from the tipping fee. You see that coming in here, tipping fee that the hauler collects through the collection rates. Recyclables are sent to market, and the revenues come back to the project. Same thing with compost, although there's a question mark there. As I noted, we're initially assigning a negative value to that product until we can get it to a point where it is marketable, but we're pretty confident that we will be able to get to that point. And then the energy that's generated from the biogas that comes out of the AD facility, that's expected to generate about 1 megawatt of net energy, and there will be revenue that comes back through an agreement with Southern California Edison. So that would be another source of revenue for the project. And again, this just kind of explains that a little bit more. So the total number of tons determine the tipping fee income there on the left. And again, as I noted, the compost is for now assumed to have a negative value, and the value of the energy is determined through the long-term contract that Mustang will enter into with Southern California Edison. And then the marketplace determines the values of the recyclable, and as I noted, those are somewhat volatile. It depends. And when oil prices are high, for instance, then plastics tend to capture a lot of revenue, and again, when they're low, they tend not to. Okay. Changes to the tipping fee, how this is going to happen. This isn't going to be very different from what we do now. There will be an annual adjustment to the tipping fee, and then that will be incorporated into our residential commercial collection rates. This just kind of shows a little bit of a flow diagram again. Franchise agreement, if needed, adjusts rates charged by the hauler, and then the hauler pays for the use of the facility by paying a tipping fee at the gate. And again, there's a reference here to the annual reconciliation process where we reconcile the tons and the revenue at the end of the year and make adjustments as necessary. Just a little bit about the performance measures and safeguards that I kind of already touched on. Facilities guaranteed to work by performance bonds, warranties, insurance requirements. City and county are not responsible if the facility doesn't work, but again, we fully expect that the facility will work. Again, it's just a reference to the bottom there to the rate stabilization fund. And then to recap, responsibilities of the city, again, our primary responsibility under this agreement is a commitment of our flow. And the tonnage amounts in value. So at the end of the year, if the costs exceed the expectations or the combined tons and the value are below the expectations, and the rate stability fund is not enough to cover that difference, then we may need to raise the rates to cover that gap. And on the flip side, if costs are below expectations and or the combined amount of the value of the sale of commodities is exceeds that, then the funds would go back to the city. If it goes over that $3.5 million threshold, then we revert funds back to the individual participants. All right, just briefly, the impact to our collection rates. As I noted earlier, the disposal costs in our collection rates are about a third of the overall cost. The bigger cost is the collection cost, and that's about two-thirds of our rates, and that covers the cost of the hauler to collect and deliver the material to the facility. And the collection costs are typically adjusted each year by a CPI adjustment. And the disposal costs, those are pass-through costs. It's just the tipping fee that's charged at the processing or disposal facilities incorporated into the collection rates. And let's see. Okay, so increases to the collection and disposal costs are multiplied by a weighting factor in our franchise agreement in the rate methodology that's specified therein. And the sum of those is applied as a percentage increase uniformly across the rates. So what does this really mean? It's difficult, I'll confess, it's difficult to fully assess the impact, what the impact is going to be on our collection rates. Let me just preface my comments here by saying that the county has taken a look at how this is going to impact county ratepayers, and they've estimated that the impact will be in the order of about $5 per account per month. The Zone 2 rates, which are, Zone 2 is the unincorporated area that surrounds the city, are very similar to our rates, even though we have different rate setting methodologies. So I'm just going to tell you right now, we're thinking that it's going to be a similar impact to our ratepayers. That differs a little bit from what I'm going to show you here, and there's reasons for that, which we can get into. But basically, what the agreement commits us to is an increase in the tipping fee from the current $87 a ton at Tahigas, effective July 1st of next year, to $99 a ton. And we feel this is necessary for a couple reasons. We need to start stepping up the tipping fee to where it's going to be when the facility becomes operational in order to moderate that increase. We don't want to make a huge jump from 87 to wherever we're going to land for the final tipping fee. And it's also, as I mentioned, these tipping fee increases going to charge initially the jurisdictional ratepayer stability fund, and we feel that we'll be able to generate the $3 million through this tipping fee increase. Okay, so going from $87 to $99 a ton, that's almost a 14% increase. But again, as I noted, there's a weighting factor that's applied, 0.33%. So what that would mean for our collection rates would be a 4.55% weighted increase that would be applied. Okay, so what does that mean exactly? Well, if you take a look, and I guess this is maybe it could have been bigger, and I apologize for that, but the column there on the left shows our current rates for different service levels. There's the 32, 64, 96-gallon residential rate, and then I've selected a three-yard, three times collected per week bin rate for commercial accounts. And the 4.55% increase to just the disposal portion of the rate, this is not taking into consideration any CPI adjustments that would have to be made to the collection portion of the rate, would result in, for a 32-gallon service level for residents, $1.19 per month increase. Now, again, I mentioned that we're looking at more on the order of a $5 per month increase, and so the question might arise, well, where's the difference here? One of the things that's not really captured in our current rate methodology is the tipping fee that's charged for the recyclable materials. When we negotiated the franchise agreement, that charge was $5 a ton, and our service, of course, includes both recyclables and green waste service. The county recognized that they needed to start increasing that tipping fee again to get it up to where the final facility tipping fee is, because it's going to be a unified tipping fee that covers all acceptable materials. So what's not really captured currently in our rate structure is the fact that we're going to have to raise the tipping fee on the recyclables, and that that's going to be something that, we're going to have to take a look at as well. So I'm just letting you know that in addition to the refuse tipping fee, and we're also going to have to make some adjustments to our rate structure to account for the fact that the recyclables tipping fee has also gone up. Okay, and then for the following year, July 1st, 2018, we would have to make another adjustment from $99 a ton to what we're not really sure what the final tipping fee for the facility is going to be upon the first day of operation, but we've put an estimated upper limit of that on $120 a ton. And I know that seems very scary, but there are a number of tools that we have available that can help us mitigate that impact to our ratepayers by subsidizing some of that increase. And we'll discuss that briefly in a little bit. So again, just to demonstrate what that jump would represent is a 21% increase in the disposal costs, or if we go through the weighted increase in the rate structure, about 7%. And again, if you just take now the rates from 2017, they're now on the left-hand column here, and applying that kind of increase, again, just to the disposal portion of the rate, would result in a $1.91 increase for a 32-gallon residential service level, and then the subsequent dollar increases for the subsequent levels of service shown there. I did want to provide you this information because in our solid waste committee meetings, the committee members did express concern about what the impact on our ratepayers would be. This is an initial look, and again, there are tools that we have available that can help us to mitigate what that final impact will be. Okay, just briefly, recommendation and next steps, because I know I've been talking for a long time and I'm sure there's lots of questions that you have. The recommendation, again, is to authorize the city manager to execute the Resource Recovery Project Material Delivery Commitment and Processing Services Agreement between the County of Santa Barbara and the City of Goleta in substantial conformity with the attached draft, again, because it's not in the final form, and subject to approval by the city attorney. So once the City of Santa Barbara and the county have finalized the language changes the city is asking for, the city attorney will review that, and if it's deemed not to materially affect what you're approving the city manager to execute, then we'll go ahead and execute the agreement. So that's the recommended action. In terms of next steps for the facility itself, once the material delivery agreements are all finalized, then there's a need to complete the permitting process. This is something that MSB has handled. My understanding is that they've gotten just about all the permits that they've needed from the Water Board, the Air Board, and what's still outstanding is the permit from Cal Recycle, which they're assiduously working on getting completed. Once the permitting is all complete, then the county can move forward with financial closing and bond issuance, and facility construction would begin sometime in 2017. And I've just put in there as just my guesstimate that would consist of grading and foundation work. And then in 2018, the facility would continue to be constructed, utilities, vertical equipment installation, and whatnot. And then full startup and acceptance testing we anticipate in the first or second month of 2019, followed by full operation thereafter. In terms of next steps for city, what we need to do, as I mentioned, we may need to re-examine the franchise agreement and our current rate setting methodology. So staff has identified a number of potential changes that may need to be made to accommodate this project. We've entered into a professional services agreement with a consultant that will assist us to evaluate the potential franchise agreement rate structure amendments. This is MSW Consultants. This is the consulting agency that helped us negotiate the franchise agreement a number of years ago. He's very familiar with our rate structure. And the other plus is he's also very familiar with this project and its requirements through work that he's been doing recently with the City of Santa Barbara. Rate adjustments to account for increased recyclables fee may need to be made, and I mentioned that earlier. And then finally, we want to explore ways to mitigate the tip fee increases to the collection rates, and we do have a number of tools to do that. The primary one would be the Jurisdictional Rate Stabilization Fund. We can use that fund, once you've charged it up, we can use some of that money to subsidize the rate impact. And then that would be backfilled during that year with revenues that are gained, and that would be a continuing revolving a possibility for us to use some of those funds help us to lower some of the impact on the rate. Anyway, I've been up here talking a whole lot. Thank you very much for your patience. We are now prepared to take any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Are there questions of Mr. King?
Yeah, I'm on the committee, so I don't have a lot of questions, but every time I hear the presentation, I learned something new, or I just didn't hear it the first time. You're saying now that we'll be charging our ratepayers for their recycling and their green waste?
Councilman Seves, members of the council, not quite. The rate that we're currently, that we've negotiated with Marburg included the $5 per ton recyclables tip fee that was charged at the time. Last July, the county raised that from $5 to $30 a ton, so there's a $25 differential there. I brought this to Marburg's attention in advance of our rate hearing, where we set rates for the current fiscal year, and raised the concern that they're now having to pay $25 more when they deliver those recyclables to the transfer station than they were paying before July 1st. I think they thanked me for bringing that to their attention. They said they would get back to us. They haven't, and I'm not sure why that is, but certainly going from $30 to $99 is going to be something that they're not going to be able to accommodate. One of the things we negotiated when we negotiated the franchise agreement was Marburg is taking the commercial recyclables in the city and processing those and selling the commodities that are realized from that. And they are keeping the revenue from that. They're not sharing that with the city. So that may be how they're handling the $25 differential that I mentioned a moment ago. But again, going from $30 to $99 a ton and then north of $100 after that is something that I suspect is going to be a problem for them. And so we're going to need to come up with a blended rate. Right now, we don't really have in our current rate methodology a way of, it's not a line item kind of a rate structure like the county and some other cities are used. So it's not easy to make that kind of adjustment. And so that's one of the things we're going to have to hammer out with Marburg and the consulting, the consultant that we've brought on.
Okay.
The green waste, that is $45 a ton. That's going to stay the same. That's not really part of the project. The green waste will continue to be processed by the county as a mulch product and distributed in agriculture as it is currently.
Okay, so the short answer is we're still going to pay for the trash and the recycling cans and the green cans where the customers are not going to be charged.
The way we negotiated the franchise agreement currently is those services are part of the rate that the customers pay, and I would expect that we would.
Is that blended in the trash rate then?
I think, yeah, they must have come up with, I'm not sure how Marburg at their end decided that the rate structure we came up with was, you know, works for them, but yes, we're going to have to come up with a blended rate or a way of accounting for the increase in the tipping fee for the recyclables. I'm not sure if that answers the question. No.
Here's my concern. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll ask it this way.
Okay.
I don't want to make recycling a disincentive or make it a disincentive for our community to recycle. If we're going to be charging for trash, charging for green, charging for the blue, then I could see people throwing everything in their trash. Why should I pay extra for a green for a recycling container? And that was my question. If we're going to start charging for recycling, then I think we have to rethink that because it's a disincentive.
Councilman Aceves, members of the council, We're not currently charging residents for recycling. I don't think that would change. I think recycling green service would still be part of the service that's included in the rate that the customer would pay. And I would expect that the current arrangement where residents can request additional recycling green waste containers without additional charge would continue to be the case as well.
Okay. One of the issues on that, as Mr. King mentioned, the upcoming steps will be to sit down and make some clarifications with Marburg. So we don't have answers to some of these questions, and council policy direction will drive how those issues play out. I believe Ms. Wells from the county may be able to elaborate a little bit on that to explain how this is not a disincentive for recycling.
Yeah, if I may, before Leslie steps in, just a moment. What I didn't mention at the end of the presentation is, of course, staff is planning to meet in the next couple of weeks to kind of flesh out what some of these potential changes would be. And then following that, we would come back to the Solid Waste Issues Committee and present those potential changes to the committee members and seek further direction before we would proceed to sit down with Marburg to really kind of get into, you know, what do we need to do here. So you will be appraised of the of what is happening every step of the way, and you will be giving us guidance about how to proceed with that. I'm sorry.
Councilmember Aceves, just a quick clarification. It's very complicated, all the different rates that we're talking about, but when we had the estimated increased cost of $5 per month to a residential customer, that's for your whole package of service. So it's sort of like cable service. So with it comes trash, recycling, and green. So I would imagine that Marburg would continue to uphold their commitment to, you can get another recycling container for free or another green waste container for free or whatever your current agreement is. It's not going to impact them in that respect in terms of what it is that you have to charge the customer specifically, because it's really a basket of services that you're subscribing to. And so we absolutely don't want to create a disincentive. Any recyclables that are collected in the green can, or excuse me, the blue can, are actually worth more. So we want to constantly be educating our residents and businesses to expand their recycling efforts. And that was part of the reason why we came up with a single tipping fee for trash and recycling, to take care of concerns about migration. Like, we don't want to build something so we're discouraging recycling. We built it so that there could be this transference of materials from either of the containers, and it's not going to negatively impact the facility overall.
All right. Are there other questions from council?
I got one or two, I suppose.
Okay, please.
So we're establishing the rate stabilization fund, which means in the front end it's going to cost a little bit more, so that we can build up this fund, right?
Councilman Vallejo, members of the council, that's correct. The step from the current $87 per ton to $99 per ton anticipated for July 1st. Is to generate revenues for that rate stabilization fund, but also to start stepping this up between where we're at now and where we're going to be. If it was just a normal tipping fee increase at the landfill, it might be much less, might be on the order of a couple $3, and that might bring us to, you know, $90 or $91. But then the following year, you'd be making a jump to, you know, north of $110. We're not really sure exactly where that's going to be. That's a big jump, and so we're trying to moderate that a little bit over the next couple of years, in addition, again, to generating the funds initially to charge that rate stabilization fund.
So do we anticipate once that fund reaches a suitable level, we'll be able to adjust the rates down a little bit at least?
That's correct. The idea is that you can use some of those funds for a subsequent year subsidy on the collection, or I'm sorry, the disposal portion of the rates.
Okay.
And then, so for instance, if you started out with a $3 million fund and you said, okay, we're going to use $1 million of that to moderate the impact to ratepayers, then in the subsequent year, the revenues that are generated from the sale of recyclables, hopefully the digestate material and energy, that come back to the public participants would recharge that. So it would be filled every year thereafter. And then you could then take again that next year some of that money and apply it to the subsequent year tipping fee increase. So it's kind of a revolving approach that you could use. That would be one way of moderating the tip fee increase.
Okay. And so you've mentioned the compost a couple of times, and I just want to make sure I understand. So we're going to have to create the market, or just get our compost to the level where somebody will want to buy it?
A little bit of both, okay. Yeah. Again, farmers are very particular about what they put on their, sure, their crops. And there's a variety of types of crops. Certain crops like silviculture trees and things like that, or orchard crops, can handle materials that you wouldn't necessarily want to put on row crops. These would be like root vegetables and things like that, which would be which can more easily or readily uptake things that might be in a compost product, like heavy metals, for instance, that might be generated from a biosolids compost, which is not what we're talking about here. But again, for our project, the major contaminant concern is, again, small, inert glass mostly. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult to screen out at the front end and the back end. But there are technologies that can do that effectively. And so once you get a material that's clean enough that the farmer will look at it and it's like, okay, it looks like I can use that. And then, of course, you would do a variety of testing on it for the salinity content and heavy metals content like that. You need to provide those nutrient values and things like that. Farmers want to know what they're putting on their crops. So we expect that it might take a few months to get, there's going to be a learning curve here. Even though the facility is state-of-the-art in terms of the equipment and the operators are fully competent in what they're doing, it's going to take a few months to ramp up to the point where you've got all the bugs worked out of the system and now you're looking at a clean product. And then comes the marketing part. And you're right. Marketing is a particular art and a science to get people to use something that you want them to use. Mm-hmm. We have some ideas about how we would be able to market that material. We're very fortunate that we live in a county that has a lot of agricultural need, so it's not like there's not a demand for it. It's just a matter of convincing different growers that this is a product that would be beneficial and economical for them to use. And we have some ideas on who might assist us with marketing. There's an individual, Mr. Ron Alexander, who's with the Composting Council. He's been involved with marketing compost products for 20 years. We've worked with him before when I was with the County of Santa Barbara. He's very, very good. So we thought about the possibility of maybe bringing him on initially to help develop markets for that material.
So, and we think we can get to the point where it's cost effective then.
Yes, we do. And again, we've already assumed a negative value for the product, and so that's not going to affect the economy. So it's only uphill from there. So anything that we can get for it is a benefit.
But we think it's months, not years. I don't mean to beat up this compost thing. Or maybe a little bit of both, maybe a year or two.
I think that we would get the product to a place where it could be sellable within months of of initial operation. Mm-hmm. Building markets is a long-term challenge. It doesn't happen overnight. So, yeah, it would be a years-long process. And again, once the initial group of farmers uses the product and are satisfied, word of mouth goes around pretty quick, and they all share at their meetings and whatnot what works for them.
Okay, just one more question then. So this rate stabilization fund is designed to help weather the storm in the commodities market when it comes to recyclables and the electricity, I guess, to a certain extent that mm-hmm. we're going to generate. So how bad of an impact would it be to taxpayers, to people paying these fees, if the wheels came off? I know a lot of it goes to China, so let's say we got in a big trade war with China and they said we're not taking any of it anymore. Mm-hmm. How bad of an impact would that be to our ratepayers if suddenly we couldn't sell any of it?
That is hard to assess. That would be a concern not just for Goleta, but pretty much for the entire West Coast.
Sure.
The fact is a lot of the material that we collect as recyclables is shipped overseas and mm-hmm. used in markets overseas. And in the case of China, that's they've restricted that somewhat. So I don't really have a full answer for that, and perhaps Leslie Wells of the county can weigh in on that, because they're the ones currently that are in charge of having these materials mm-hmm. set down in Ventura, and so they're just much more familiar with that.
And I realize that's probably extreme. I doubt it dries up completely, but I'm just trying to gauge the impact, I guess.
So, Councilmember Vallejo, when the Goleta Incorporated area was part of the unincorporated area, we started source-separated recycling collection, I think, in our franchise agreement starting in 1997. And at that time, we were sorting recyclables at the transfer station. We had an old broccoli belt, and we had folks standing on either side. And then when we went to these big containers, we thought, whoa, okay, we need to actually send this to a legitimate processing plant. So since we've been contracting for that, we were already in the habit of collecting monthly what were the value of recyclables by commodity. And so we just asked our contractor to keep providing that information. So we have, like over 20 years of data mm-hmm. on the recycling market. 2008, the fall of 2008 is the time we saw the biggest plunge we've ever seen. And even then, it wasn't all the commodities. It was the paper market, some of the plastics. So some of the metals were still mm-hmm. cranking out some revenue. So we've never seen full scale going off the cliff with all the commodity values. But just sitting here, and I was thinking about the same question, and I was looking at, we're anticipating about $9.4 million in recycling revenue. So if that were to suddenly reduce in half, which we've never seen, it never reduced in half in 2008, it looks like, in applying Everett's 33% of the collection rate is associated with disposal, it would end up with a 5% increase to the rate payer.
Okay.
So it's not, I mean, it's a lot, and we don't like to have over like 2% increases to our rate payers, and we do everything we can to avoid that, but it's not catastrophic.
Okay. That's what I wanted to make sure. Great. Thank you.
I'd just like to add, if I may, the commodity values that we're expecting to get in the tipping fee are set on very conservative 12-month period, really the lowest 12-month period of commodity sales that we've seen. So we've taken a very conservative approach in picking a very low threshold. And I don't want to, again, repeat myself. It's all uphill from there. But, yeah, we're hoping that we're at the bottom.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you.
All right. Are there other comments from council members? Yeah, Mr. Bennett.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that, you know, at the end of the day, we don't really have a lot of options. The only place that our trash can go to right now is Tahiguas. And it's got an end date if we don't do anything. That's going to come real quick. If we go forward with this, we know that it's going to last at least another 22 years and likely to go much further than that because technology will continue to improve and our ability to recycle more make more out of this is going to be much greater than what we know of today. So at the end of the day, the city of Goleta doesn't really have an option because for us to pay for our waste to go elsewhere or to do something entirely different, I know Santa Maria, when I first came on the committee, was moving forward with the purchase of the ranch, Las Flores Ranch, or whatever, to be their new solid waste. It hasn't happened yet. And the likelihood of that is getting more difficult because the laws are becoming far more stringent. You can't just do what used to be done to create solid waste facilities. So the fact of the matter is, having been on this thing as long as I have, and I know I didn't make any friends one day when I was off the committee for a couple of years, went back on the committee and said, wow, this is like Groundhog Day, because literally, it didn't seem to me that anything had changed. It was the same thing being discussed that I recall had been discussed 2 years before I left. So anyway, I'm glad to see where we're at. I thank everyone because I know I've heard it. I've been a part of it on just a little bit of the frustration to get to this point, to put this thing together. And everyone has worked incredibly hard and diligent to get us to this point. And I think it's a real positive milestone. I mean, I think all the risks have been laid out. The potential impacts have been laid out. But at the end of the day, we need this. And it's going to be an ultimate benefit to our community and to the rest of the South Coast and to the cities of Bealton and Sawbang as well. So, I just can't say enough how positive I believe this all to be. So, thank you all for all the work you've done.
Councilmember Perotti.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, I'd just like to echo what Councilmember Bennett said. I don't think we have any other choice. I mean, I think what you, first of all, Mr. King, thank you so much for this great report. And you made something that was very complicated to understand, understandable. Thank you. And thank you for your report today. I think what you said in this report that really got me and I highlighted it was, it's on page 2. It said development of a new landfill is a long and expensive process. And is that really what we want to do? But more importantly, it is a significant avoidable environmental impact. And I think that's what it boils down for me. So I support this. There was initially in the beginning, and I mentioned it to Ms. Green when we had an agenda review, there was some rumbling within the community, and there are people that groups that were opposed to Higas being the site. I haven't heard much. Has that all been resolved, or are the groups that were initially years ago had some concerns and wanting the Gaviota Coast to remain, you know, without a landfill? I haven't heard anything from them.
Didn't the Falcon take care of that?
Council Member Perotti, members of the council. It's true. There were some groups, Gaviota Coastal Conservancy and a couple other groups, that while they supported the projects conceptually, their objection was the location of it. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, even though we thought that it was possible that litigation would come out of the EIR, that turned out not to be the case. We've made numerous presentations to a wide variety of groups about this project over the years. I'll let Leslie, I think she has some additional comments to make on that. Hi, Leslie. Sorry, Mark.
Sorry, you get the ugly Leslie. I just wanted to add to Everett's comments regarding the EIR. We spent a lot of time and did a lot of due diligence to make sure it was complete and thoroughly vetted. We studied other locations in the urban area at the request of the Gaviota Coast, and ultimately the project and its location was the best choice for that project from an environmental perspective. As you know, when the decision-making body makes a notice of determination on a project, that starts the clock for a lawsuit to be filed. That time has come and gone, and we did not get a lawsuit filed on this project by any group regarding the project. That doesn't mean they're happy with the outcome. It doesn't mean they're still not trying to figure out ways to affect the outcome, but that's not there. I also want to get up and just talk about maybe just in general the rates and our approach to the rates. The project has always been, let's protect the ratepayer, because ultimately they're the ones that are going to let us know whether it's fair or right. And so we've done a lot of conservative estimates in what the project cost is going to be. I mean, the recyclable level has significantly been reduced, where it's, I think, added almost $4 or $5 to the tip fee that we're proposing today. There was concern, and these are things that have come out where we stressed this project regarding the loss of self-haul material that kind of goes into the system. And that not only includes the South Coast Transfer Station and the San Ynez Transfer Station, but the Marburg Transfer Station. So they came to us and they said, for us to preserve the material that's currently coming to us from the community at their choice, this is a competitive price we need to have. And so we're working on an agreement for them to continue to bring their material to our system. And so in exchange for that, we're giving them a favorable price at their gate so they can remain competitive in the market so they don't lose that, because if they lose that, we lose. We have done a lot of those things to be conservative. As Everett has done a great job of explaining, a lot of the risk has been shifted to the public entities, and our response to that risk is to lower our expectations and be conservative. That has resulted in a slightly higher rate to our ratepayer, right? But if the numbers come in as they think they will, and if things get better in the recyclable markets, there's this jurisdictional rate fund that the money flows to that then we will return to the jurisdictions based on their partition level, that they can then pass that rate on to their ratepayers. And that's how we mitigate those rates into the future. It's real important. The bonding company wants to see the ability of us to make our mortgage payment, make it for the next 20 years. So they want to see us raise our rates to get to that, being able to make that mortgage payment. That's why we have the first year increase next year and the increase the following year. But on the flip side, because we've been very conservative in our estimates, we believe unless things dire straits come on, 50% reduction in recyclable rates, 5% increase, that we will be able to this project will have funds that will be replenished to the jurisdictions based on their level of participation. And really with that, Everett did do a great job, phenomenal job. He's a phenomenal team member to the project, and I've appreciated everything he's done. Hope I'm embarrassing him a little bit. Rosemary's been very helpful. Tim's been very helpful. Michelle's been very helpful as needed. They've stepped in at the right time for the right level of input. And as Councilmember Bennett once said, actually many times every time I see him, it reminds me of Groundhog Day. My rebuttal to that is a proverb I once read, that if you want to go if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I just thank you for your participation and being our partner in this project. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Any other comments from council?
Yeah, just tell Councilman Bennett to take it easy on these people over here.
Hey, why? That's the way he treats us. So why? No, actually, Solid Waste has obviously done a good job here. I wanted to ask a question, and then I don't know whether we're through with deliberation or not, but it sounds like we're close to it. The green fence thing, is that something that we institute to keep from polluting the rest of the world, that we establish a certain minimum standard before we'll send it overseas?
Councilman, Mayor Farr, members of the committee, you're very funny. No, that's not something that was entirely imposed by the Chinese government. Again, a lot of the material that was being sent over was pretty dirty. And at some point, you know, as an economy and a country and a society that's advancing and developing, just like it happened here, you know, as living standards go up, people have higher expectations in terms of environmental protection and whatnot. And so my understanding is that the Chinese government just kind of put its foot down and says, you know, we're not going to accept this level of contamination. It was a contamination issue primarily.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the first time I've ever heard of the Chinese doing something like that. So, of course, they've signed the global warming thing, so maybe, you know, we'll get out of this mess someday. So, all right, let me just add my kudos to the job that you've done, Mr. King. It was an excellent presentation, and I agree with Ms. Perotti and Mr. Bennett and everybody else, really. The time has come, so I don't think we really have much of a choice here, and the county has obviously done, I can't imagine how much work this has been through the last decade or decade and a half, but you've done a nice job. There are a ton of moving parts here, obviously, and you seem to have softened or eliminated objections to the project, and certainly won me over. So is there someone who wants to make a motion?
I'd love to make the motion.
All right, Mr. Bennett.
As recommended by staff, approval of the Resource Recovery Project Material Delivery Commitment and Processing Services Agreement between the County of Santa Barbara and the City of Goleta. And I think what needs to be added on there is subject to the city attorney's final approval based on some potential changes.
The recommendation on page one of our staff report, it does say in substantial conformity with the attached draft. So you're saying replace that with, instead of in substantial conformity, you want it to be with subject to the approval of.
I would just say, okay, go ahead and as written is fine.
Oh, okay.
Second.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Passes unanimously. Yeah, that's good. All right. Thank you again, folks. Mr. King, that was very well done. So
thank you.
And thank you, folks from the county, too. Okay, we are at council comments and standing committee reports. If Councilmember Aceves, do you want to start off?
Just remind everybody, Saturday for Beautify Goleta, 9 to 1, Mallard, Launder Drive. Want to come down and help? Help. You want to come down and just see the action? See the action, but it's going to be a great event. The only thing I have to report is this last week I attended our CalAFCO conference, which was held in Santa Barbara for, I believe, the first and now last time, because now they're going to alternate sites through the state, and it's going to be like San Diego and Sacramento. Yesterday we had our public safety committee meeting, talked about our public safety fund, the parking enforcement officer up. We had an update on the parking enforcement officer. The sheriff's department currently has that position in backgrounds, and our staff is working on the enforcement plan, which more likely will come back to council because there'll be some changes on probably some changes on recommended changes such as curbing, etc. And then we had an update on our Red Cross trailers. You know, council's on record wanting to go from 2 to 4, and so we're trying to make that happen. And that's my report.
All right, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
Okay, thank you. So I guess first I want to commend staff and the Sheriff's Department for and UCSB and their students and everybody involved in the Halloween festivities, or lack thereof, I guess is a better way to put it, in Isla Vista this weekend. Everybody's really pitched in, I think. It's obviously been a concerted effort, and especially the students. They've really done a good job of policing themselves, and it's neat to see that it's now hopefully becoming old hat, or we don't have big issues out there for Halloween. I heard you could, hopefully nobody goes and literally tries this, but you could throw a rock down the middle of DP on Friday and Saturday night, and you wouldn't hit anybody. It was very quiet out there, which is nice to hear. So, and of course, our staff did a great job keeping our community quiet and safe, and so great job. I had a chance to attend, and I think I had a couple of, at least one, I know Councilman Aceves was there. The Boys Club did their gala. I don't know if I saw anybody else. I'm not trying to call anybody out, but I don't know if I saw anybody else. It was hugely successful. They raised a lot of money for a really worthy cause. They gave awards to Nancy Weiss, who's with the school district, and the person on the school district side responsible for feeding all those kids, not just in Goleta, but on the west side, and I believe one other location too. They're doing that. That went well. I think we should all personally thank Virgil Ellings if we see him again. They do a fundraiser thing, and I don't want to take too much time, but it was such a memorable moment that they actually just asked people for money, and without an auction item, just kind of, do you want to give money? And they do different levels, and they got to $58,000, and the auctioneer said, nobody's ever said yes to this, but does anybody want to match that total? And Virgil did. He wrote a check for $58,000 to match that. So if you happen to bump into him, make sure you tell him thank you. That was an amazingly generous offer. I attended the Radius Economic Forecast. Overall, good news. I think the economist there was much more optimistic than other people are about our economy. Overall, we're doing well. He was speaking mostly nationally, but overall, we're doing well. Locally, real estate, which of course is what Radius would focus on, is still very competitive, still a tight market for all aspects of it. So that went well as well. I mean, that was good news in that regard. It also means that, you know, we have a lot of businesses struggling to find a place to work and people finding a place to live. So that's going to continue to be a challenge for all the communities, really, on the entire in Southern California. I mean, it's not an issue specific to Goleta. And then last but not least, we had another Christmas parade committee meeting, and that's going forward. They're working with staff to get final approval and everything, to get their permits and stuff, and the fundraising side's going well. We should be able to raise the money we need, and we will be doing a Christmas parade December 10th at 6:30 in Old Town. We're still working out logistics and things like that, but everybody should plan on being able to see a Christmas parade here in Goleta for the first time maybe ever. I don't know. I guess I should look to Councilman Bennett when I talk about history of Goleta. I don't think we've ever done a Christmas parade, at least in Old Town, right?
Yeah, we used to have a parade, but it wasn't at Christmas time that I recall.
Yeah.
So, I can't answer that. I don't know for sure.
Okay, so this will be exciting. So keep it on your calendars, December 10th. We're a little over a month away. So that's all I have.
All right, very good. Do you think it would be appropriate for us to think of some way to honor Virgil Ellings for his contribution? He's been very good to our city here.
He has. I mean, his contribution was to United Boys and Girls Club, not necessarily Goleta, which doesn't mean that Goleta doesn't get, you know, share the benefit of it. I certainly don't see why we shouldn't. I mean, just as a way of, heck, the event happened in Goleta. He made the donation here in Goleta.
Oh, maybe so, you think he gave it to us.
Yeah, well, not to Goleta, but in Goleta. So.
Yeah, all right. Well, we should probably chat about that, yeah. Maybe. All right, Councilmember Perotti, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Okay, so continue to attend the weekly Central Coast Collaborative on Homelessness Regional Committee on Wednesday the 19th and the 26th. We have six clients that we're working with, and we did house one. That was a really great accomplishment. On October the 26th, that same Wednesday, the 26th, we had our monthly meeting for C3H here, and we have them here in this room, and that was very well attended. October the 27th, City Manager Michelle Green and myself attended the Girls Inc. It was their 15th annual celebration luncheon. It was held at the Bacara, and it was titled Women in Leadership Making a Difference. And the honored speaker was Hannah Beth Jackson. But what really stole the show, I think, were there was an eighth grader. Her name was Roz. She's from La Colina. And then Maya, a sixth grader from Kellogg. They were the most, I just can't even put it into words. They were so incredible. They were so mature, and they spoke so well without notes. I mean, maybe they looked down occasionally, but it was just, I mean, I thought, wow, they do so much better than I do. I mean, they were great. So I feel like our future is looking good with these young women and Girls Inc. It was pretty inspirational. October the 31st, which was yesterday, we had our something that I don't usually attend, but I invited our public information officer from the Santa Barbara County Fire, Dave Zanboni.
Zanboni.
Zanboni, a nice Italian name. I invited him to come and speak. This is the meet and greet are for the homeless community. They come and they have lunch and they pick up clothes, and it's monthly at the Galena Valley Community Center. And I asked him to come and speak to the folks there about fire danger. And even though we had a little bit of rain recently, we're still considered high fire. It's high fire season. And he spoke to them about how really no open flame fire is allowed at all. And I think it was well received. And I know that they, for the ones that, the folks that weren't there, the homeless population is pretty good about spreading the word. And I think they'll take it back to the folks that they know. And I think he really got the message across. So I'm really glad that he came. He had a good way of putting it forward, and they asked great questions. So I think that's it for me. Thank you.
Very good. Councilmember Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I attended my Santa Barbara Airport Commission meeting as our liaison on the 19th of October. And there were two items that I think are of interest to us, and I will have copies for you. One is that the airport is, over the last 3 months now, has been consistent in upping the number of people that are going to the airport and arrivals and departures, which is a very good thing. It makes it much more healthy. It had been declining, as you may all know, for years and years. So now it's beginning to tick up, and that's a real positive thing for our business community and for our tourist community, et cetera, for our economy overall. So that's a real positive. And then there's a issue called the Metroplex, which is a reassignment of flights of aircraft. And it's has to do with all over, but more specifically for us, we're a part of the Southern California area. And they didn't go into great detail. They indicated that there was no significant change here, and I have some information, but I'll leave it to all of you to take a look at it, and I'm going to ask that staff pursue that a little bit more so that we can have somebody that has a much greater understanding than I do. I'm willing to accept the fact that maybe it doesn't have a big impact on us, but I don't really know that for a fact. And as I say, the information that I received wasn't that definitive. other than it's not a major change. And that may be very true, and I'm trusting, but I'd like to verify that fact to make sure, because that is an issue in our community that comes up from time to time, the aircraft overhead. And then I'd like to just, I think I said this before, but if I haven't, I apologize. Mr. Kemp retired from SB CAG, and he had a retirement party last Thursday, the 20th of October, that I attended. And bottom line is, he's not quite leaving yet, because the new SB CAG director, which has been selected, and we've approved her contract at our last meeting, bottom line is that she won't be back until the 1st. So 1st of January, she will be taking over that responsibility. So he's going to stay in and up to the holidays, and then he'll be finished at that time. So if there's, I know that Roger has served on the commission, so if you want to say hi and goodbye, why, he's still there until that time period for that purpose. Moving ahead here, let's see, I lost my place. People's Self-Help had a little celebration downtown. I attended that Friday evening. Saturday, I was supposed to go to the Special Olympics. I had a little, I didn't feel so well, so I ended up kind of hanging real close to home. Didn't go anywhere. And so I unfortunately missed that, but I had been looking forward to that, because I knew that that was a conflict with the boys and girls, and I knew that some were going to go that direction. I thought I'd go the other direction and represent us, but I unfortunately didn't make that. Our last Ivy Safe committee meeting, this is the district attorney's committee that she formed, that I sit on. We went over the last of the preparations for the Halloween, and by all indications, the expectation was that things have worked very, very successfully, and we've worked incredibly close with the students and the student leadership. And Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo is absolutely accurate and correct when he says that the success has come from the students. It's the students that have stepped up. And it's really a pleasure to see the leadership that has taken hold out there, and the effort that's gone forward. And I think it's a testament to the efforts that we put forth and the extra efforts that we've put forth in the county and also the city of Goleta. I think the university's taken additional responsibility. I think it shows it all works. But at the end of the day, it would never work if the students didn't step up. And they clearly have. It's made just a huge difference. So we're pretty excited. We're, as a group, who started soon after the carnage this last time around. We had hopes, but we weren't sure where we were going to go. And so I'm not suggesting for a minute that our group single-handedly made all the changes. I don't think that occurred. But we certainly were a focus point that helped assist that process and make things go forward. So I've been a real proud participant in that particular group. And then from that, I was invited to attend the youth program in Santa Barbara City. No other politicians attended. It was on the marijuana initiative. Yeah. So I showed up. There was one council member from the city. That person immediately disappeared. So, but I sat on the panel and enjoyed every moment of it. And it was educational for me. I think it was educational for many of the people that were participants. They had some great questions, and so I'm real happy that I was asked and I attended and got to participate on the panel. And let's see, I went to also the Radius Economic Forecast where Christopher Thornburg from Beacon Economics spoke. He's the founding member of that organization, and he had spoken at our League of Cities conference. And so he changed it somewhat, his presentation, focused it a little more for the Central Coast and in the South Coast in particular. But it was essentially the same speech he had made down there. And it is very provocative, and I thought very interesting. And I think the information that was contained in the booklet that they gave all of us is informative. And I passed the information on to our city manager for her review. So again, I have to say, I think that was pretty nice. And I went to a fundraiser for the Salvation Army on Thursday, and all I did was hand out candy last night. Had more people than I typically have, so that was a good thing. And shut everything down at 9 o'clock, and that was the end of that. So that was the end of my joy.
Well, I knocked on your door at 10, and I didn't get a response.
Good reason.
Yeah. So if I can segue for just one quick second, Michelle, our attempts to get some mitigation out of Santa Barbara for that development north of Hollister, is that underway still?
I think the city attorney should comment on that because he is the person who has been working with the city of Santa Barbara's legal counsel on the effort to make sure that we receive that mitigation.
Yes, in discussions with the officials at the city of Santa Barbara on behalf of the city, we did file an appeal of the Planning Commission decision just to give ourselves a forum to discuss that matter. The officials there have been very open and willing to discuss with us to make sure that adequate mitigation is provided as part of the project. We don't have a solution at this point in time, but we have agreed that we will work with them through this process to identify appropriate mitigation.
All right. Well, that's at least there's an admission on their part that there is an impact that needs to be addressed. So that's good. Still moving in the right direction. Then. Thank you, sir. All right. I have no report. Ms. Green, do you have a report you'd like to give us?
I just have two items I'll briefly mention for the public's benefit. On Friday, November 11th, we will be observing Veterans Day here at City Hall, so we will not be open. Some people think we're not open on Fridays anyway, but that's not actually the case. This particular Friday, we will be fully closed, though. The next city council meeting that we will have will actually be on a Monday, which is a departure from our typical routine, Monday, November 14th. And that's all I had.
All right. Mr. Giles, do you have a report? No. All right. Well, unless someone has an objection, then we'll close this afternoon session of the Goleta City Council.
And very soon, I saw you kissing someone new, I saw you kissing someone